Tonight on The Download, Iranian-Canadian filmmaker and journalist Mazyar Bahari, Chicago singer-songwriter Stephanie Rogers, and another installment of The Swap Meet with Greg Flam. Now, here's your host, a man who realized he doesn't own a sweatshirt, Justin Kaufman.
It's so true. It's perfect sweatshirt weather, right? And I feel like here I am going through my closet and I realize I don't have any sweatshirt. I don't have a college sweatshirt. I don't have a hoodie. I don't have anything. Is this what happens when you get older? I thought it was the other way around. I thought as I got older, it'd just be all sweatshirts all the time. Sweatpants too. Hey, everybody, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up for you tonight. I'm so excited to be here and so excited to bring you a couple great segments. Mike Fouché is going to be here from the Daily Line coming up here after the 7:30 news. And also joining us will be Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who's in the news today as he was picked to be the lieutenant governor choice for State Senator Daniel Biss in his run for governor, state of Illinois. Today, Senator Biss put out a statement saying he's dropping Alderman Rosa from the ticket. We'll talk with the alderman about why that happened. It has to do with his stance on Israel. So we'll talk with the alderman about that coming up here after the 7:30 news. At 8 o'clock tonight, sort of on the same topic, Mazyar Bahari will be in studio. Mazi is a filmmaker. He's a journalist. He's also a I would assume at this point, I guess you call him, I don't know what you call him. What do you call him when someone takes your story and makes it a film? Subject? His memoir about his time he spent in an Iranian prison when he was a correspondent for Newsweek in 2009 after the elections. He was covering the protests after the elections in 2009. He was put in prison, accused of being a spy and bearing witness to a crime in that essentially is the category that the Iranian regime puts on journalists, saying if you witness, meaning you document, you tape, record, broadcast something that's happening that's a crime, you can go to prison for it. So they put that in the category because he was covering a protest. He has been a tremendous advocate, human rights activist for journalists around the world, including in Iran. He has stood up to regimes all over who have decided to take the stance of oppression and to sort of limit freedom of press, freedom of speech. And some countries are just, that's just not a thing. We'll talk with him tonight. He's in town because he's the keynote at the big luncheon for the U.S. Holocaust Museum. His latest project, and this is really interesting, is focusing on the Iranian regime's longstanding approach to the Holocaust. They have been on record, they're the only country on record in the entire world that denies the Holocaust ever happened. You watch the clips of some of the former Iranian leaders and they twist around it and they stand by it. And it has worked in some cases where citizens in Iran and other places believe it never happened. And so Mazyar Bahari's mission is to take that on. He's working on documentaries, and he really wants to sort of focus on Muslims, especially in Iran, to say, hey, take a look. Here's the facts. It did happen. Your government's lying to you. It's interesting. I didn't know much about it. I know there are a lot of people listening right now say, oh, yeah, we all know that. You know, I'm talking to Jeff and Roe, and that's something that's well known by a lot of people. But to think about it in 2017, it's difficult to comprehend that a country would still take on that approach to something that, a terrible incident that eradicated 6 million Jews. It's crazy. So we'll talk with him at the big table tonight. He's in town. Also later, we will talk with Wild Cloud Theater Company about horror, staging horror, 10-year anniversary for that company. Stephanie Rogers will be here to talk about Story Jam, which is going to be at City Winery this weekend. And we got the swap meet with Greg Flam back in the building, where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk, all that coming up tonight on The Download. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back and do the carry out. Stay with us. All right, so download here on 720 WGN. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. President Trump's already over the new session in Congress. He went above GOP leaders and made his own deal with Democrats on the debt ceiling. Well, that was fast and without drama, which, let's face it, is exactly why Trump was hired, right? The other stuff, well, that was all in the fine print. But Trump doesn't want to let hurricane relief cash get caught up in politics, so now Trump can move faster to tax reform and other pressing issues like immigration. So what does that mean for the GOP in Congress? Pretty soon they're going to be doing press conferences in front of nobody in D.C. Hello, this is Speaker Ryan. Thanks for coming. Hey, everybody, Trump's having an ice cream sundae party at the White House. Let's all go. Yay, you can't come. Oh, darn. Illinois joins a few other states in suing the Trump administration over the discontinuation of DACA. They believe it's unconstitutional and are suing in the New York state system. Add to the mix that it looks like cities like Chicago and others will enact their own local versions of DACA to protect dreamers in this country. And that means we're going to be up to our eyeballs in immigration news for the next gazillion years. Every day. So let's track this story. First, Congress doesn't act on immigration. Stonewalls, then President Obama. Obama takes action through the White House. Supreme Court kind of kicks it back down. Now president undoes old president's work and tells Congress it's time to act. Congress isn't going to do anything. So the states get in the business hoping that it'll go to the Supreme Court. Wow. So what's next? I mean, obviously, if you're geometry, is it algebra? I think it's algebra. It would be that the next president would undo this president's thing and we just do this all over again. It's like an exhausting game of political chutes and ladders. Or worse, Jenga. Which is nothing like this metaphor, but that's an exhausting game. In local politics, Democrat gubernatorial candidate Daniel Biss chose Chicago Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa as lieutenant governor running mate. But after some criticized Rosa's stance on Israel and high-profile endorsements like Congressman Brad Schneider walked, today Biss reversed course and dropped Rosa from the bill. Not a great look to start the campaign, but look at it this way. Maybe Biss will save on some poster space. Ramirez Rosa, it's a lot of letters. And the hyphen? Hyphens can be expensive, trust me. The Trib editorial board slammed Biss for not vetting Ramirez Rosa. Hold on a second. It's not like he had a record, right? He told a magazine that he didn't like that Israel messes with Palestine. Maybe not great for Biss's base, but he didn't go all Mel Gibson on us. Calm down. Alderman Pawar today gave the okay for a new residential development in the old Sears store in Ravenswood, the one on Lawrence Avenue. I don't know about you, but I've always dreamed of living in a Sears. Think about it. If your washing machine breaks, or you need a wrench, or I don't know, a Cuisinart. I don't know what else they sell at Sears, but it should come with the new condo. Congress has a ton on its plate this fall, so naturally they start by trying to push legislation through to get self-driving cars on the old fast track. As Congress approves it, Chicago wants to slow it down like two bickering parents teaching robots how to drive. Come faster, slower. Watch your six. Park right here, parallel. Back up. I'm just a robot. Please, I just want to see Fallout Boy next week at House of Blues. Can I go? No, cannot, robot. Facebook is being accused of cooking the books. They say they have more people on the site than the U.S. Census says exists. Really? The home of fake news has allegedly faked their numbers? You don't say. Next, you're going to tell me that the Russian woman in the bikini who requested my friendships is not real. Don't answer that. I want to live in a bubble. And weather, it's nice here, but not so much in the Caribbean. Hurricane Irma is bearing down on the islands, and the power company there said the entire island of Puerto Rico will be without electricity for 4 to 6 months. 4 to 6 months. So the next time the storm kills the lights in your neighborhood for 20 minutes, remember that. 4 to 6 months. This is a serious storm, one that's knocking out the instruments that measure these storms. That's serious. Also, price gouging reports out of Florida as some airlines are taking the opportunity to charge more for people trying to leave. The Hill had a report that an American Airlines flight from Miami to D.C. went from $400 to $1,900. And the airline responded by saying, hey, it's supply and demand. Let me go ahead and 1 second here, guys. Sorry, need to add a certain company to my list. Go ahead and write this down in my list notebook. Got it. Good. All set. Where were we? You're on the list. You just made the list. In sports, well, the Cubs got word that Jake Arrieta should miss 7 to 10 days with a hamstring strain. That's possibly two starts, which is fine. But the hopes is that Arrieta is able to be back at 100% by playoff time. Speaking of playoffs, the Cubs have lost 3 in a row, but things are okay because the Brewers, they just don't want it. The Brewers have also lost 3 in a row, including today against the Reds. I think it gets swept by the Reds. Now 4 games back, but huge series coming up this weekend at Wrigley. That'll go a long way to seeing how September is going to play out for the Cubbies. Wilson Contreras is getting closer to returning, which is good since he's allegedly been creeping in porn star DMs on Twitter. Porn star tweeted at the Cubs to come get their boy and then attached screenshots of him trying to get her to talk to him. Contreras camp says he was hacked, but Deadspin makes a good point that it was 3 different interactions over a month's time. Long time to be hacked. The incident just reminds you that the Cubs, they're teenagers. Really. I mean, the whole team is under 25 years old. How old is Wilson Contreras? 22? The Sox lost again last night. We'll probably lose tonight, too. The only good news is that the season's almost over? No. The good news is that this year means that the Sox will have one of the top draft picks in next year's draft. So that's great for all the 4-year-old Sox fans who will start being interested in baseball right when these players start to make it to the big leagues. Youngster Ronaldo Lopez goes tonight for the Sox. It's Wednesday before the first game for the Bears. This is usually when you get the press conference that lists the injury report. So let me paraphrase. Everybody's injured. Good? We good? Mitch Trubisky, the backup quarterback. That's what you wanted, Chicago, right? You got it. Yeah. The Bears start against the NFC champion Atlanta Falcons. Man, what a slap in the face of the Falcons that they have to start their season not only on the road, but against the lowly Bears at noon. I mean, going to be the third or fourth announcing team for Fox. You know, this is a game that's usually reserved for, like, I don't know, Jacksonville versus Tennessee. That being said, I think the Bears win big. I don't know what the record is, but the Falcons never win when they come to Chicago. I mean, I'm basing most of that anecdotal stuff on the fact that they came to Soldier Field during the 85 season and we won 36-0. And last I checked, Steve Barkowski isn't quarterback anymore for the Falcons. But still, Bears in a route this Sunday. You heard it here first, right? Right. Seahawks defensive star Michael Bennett has retained a lawyer after Las Vegas police allegedly used excessive force and drew their guns at him. After the Mayweather-McGregor fight two weeks ago. There were gunshots in the area. Police apprehended Bennett, who tweeted out, "Cops pulled a gun on me for being a black man in the wrong place at the wrong time." Bennett has been sitting during the national anthem to protest inequality. See how that plays out. Northwestern's in North Carolina for a showdown with Duke on Saturday. Duke won 60-7 in their week one debut against, I don't even know who they played, some sort of assistant state team. Is that how that works? Some sort of state. There was a state in there. But they're high-flying, and they're in the ACC, so this isn't a walk in the park for the Cats. But still, Northwestern could see themselves ranked with a win on the road at Duke. Notre Dame currently at 24. And the Chicago Sky, get this story, are big losers in the new WNBA playoff format. Instead of taking the top 4 teams from each conference and having them play until they meet in the finals, nope. They're going with the top 8 overall, giving the 5th-place team in the West, the Seattle Storm, the playoff nod over the East 4th-place Sky. Does that make sense? So to put it in terms we all can understand, the Sky got hosed. Yeah. And finally tonight, the Museum of Broadcast Communications announced they're going to be bringing a national touring exhibit dedicated to Saturday Night Live to the State Street Museum in October. If this is a true SNL exhibit, get ready to be excited, disappointed, and then fall asleep before it's over. That's the carryout for September 6, 2017. Hey, we're all about that pumpkin spice. You like pumpkin spice pizza? How about pumpkin spice chicken? We've got pumpkin spice ribs. It's a dry rub. All right, coming up, Alderman Carlos Ramirez-Ross is going to join us, along with Mike Fouché. We'll talk about politics, a big move today. Our state senator, Daniel Biss, reversed course and dropped his candidate for lieutenant governor. It's coming up on the download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you tonight?
Not letting go of summer, buddy.
You look good. Anyone who's watching during the web camera that we have here, you can see Rob in awesome Hawaiian
shirt on.
I wish everybody could see that shirt.
It's a good shirt. It's worth tuning in.
I can hear it.
I've often said that people can sense what I'm wearing. as I'm delivering the news.
I think it looked good.
It's a Jedi thing.
Yeah. That's our Master Jedi.
We're having fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, as he is every Wednesday night, Mike Fouché. Mike Fouché, The Daily Line, covers Chicago politics.
Good
Cook
to be
County,
here.
Springfield. Good to see you, buddy. How
yeah,
you been?
I'm awesome, thanks.
All right, so let's get right to it. Today we're going to talk about what happened to city council, some borrowing plans, some other things. But the big news in state politics is the announcement today that State Senator Daniel Biss reversed decision on Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa as his running mate for lieutenant governor.
Yeah, this is a huge deal.
Set this story up because this is something that started to bubble up a little bit.
Right.
Namely, when Brad Schneider, the congressman on the North Shore, changed his endorsement.
First off, the drama of all this is that right now candidates are out trying to collect signatures to put them on the ballot. So Biss making this change at the last minute really screws up his signature collecting operation, which he has to really get done in the next month and a half or so. So, you know, this and he's got to find somebody else that's going to be his running mate.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know, who wants to do that now, right? So what this all goes down to is that Congressman Brad Schneider a couple of weeks ago came out with a statement saying that he was withdrawing his support of Daniel Biss for governor because Biss's running mate at the time, Alderman Carlos Rosa, was a supporter of BDS, which is, for those of you who don't know, BDS is a program divest sanction against Israel because of their treatment of Palestinians. And that Carlos Rosa supposedly was in support of BDS, and that for that reason, Congressman Schneider and other leading Jews in the North Shore could not support Biss for that
now,
reason.
Now, the choice of Alderman Rosa was intriguing in the sense that this was everyone knows Alderman Rosa to be a progressive Democrat from Chicago.
He's a major leader in the Democratic Socialists of America.
So the idea being that this was really going to cement State Senator Daniel Biss as the progressive choice Democrats for governor.
And to draw a lot of Bernie supporters.
Right.
That's the big expectation.
Rosa was a delegate.
Very early
Bernie
supporter
Sanders,
of Bernie Sanders.
So let's do this. Let's bring him in. Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa is on the line with us now. Alderman Rosa, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's talk about this because there's a lot of in the statement today that Senator Biss put out, there was sort of this statement that you changed course, that you changed your where you stood on this issue, and he didn't know about it, that's why he was reversing course. What happened here? What I mean, to take us up to this point of why you were dropped from the ticket.
Yeah, so, you know, I have been consistent in my position for a number of years in numerous public forums, and I want to explain exactly what that position is. I support a two-state solution that ends occupation of Palestine, that recognizes Israel's right to exist with security, and recognizes the humanity of the Israeli and Palestinian people. And I believe that the U.S. federal government has a role to play in exerting pressure to achieve that two-state solution. And that's why I said that the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement is part of a constructive dialogue that finds the most effective tool that the U.S. can exert to bring about that two-state solution. And at the same time, I've been consistent in my opposition to BDS at the state and local level because foreign policy is the purview of the federal government and not local jurisdictions.
But there are people who say that this is actually really not just a federal issue. In fact, last year, State Treasurer Frerichs put out a press release trumpeting that the state was investing in Israel bonds. I mean, the state has a significant amount of money to invest, and it has relationships with Israel for various economic reasons. I mean, this is a state issue to some extent as governor and lieutenant governor.
Yeah, and I was consistent in my opposition to BDS at the state and local level. When this issue came before the city council in 2015, I voted to ensure that the city would not support BDS. My opposition to it is on a distinction between local and the federal government. So I believe that this is a foreign policy issue. I believe that the question here is to determine when it comes to governments, what role does the U.S. federal government play in exerting pressure and then projecting leadership to bring about a two-state solution? And I believe that BDS is part of a constructive dialogue. We have to figure out what's the best way for the U.S. government to exert pressure to bring about a two-state solution.
So why do you think that if this is something that isn't a federal, it isn't a state issue, and if it's just the federal purview, Why do you think that Daniel Biss all of a sudden has to make such, I mean, put you aside, okay? I know this is kind of a bad thing for you, but I mean, a decision right now to do this, Daniel Biss must actually really think that this is a significant issue for him and his campaign. Why would he make such a big decision if it wasn't a state issue?
You know, I was hopeful that we would find a way to articulate our differences on the role that the BDS movement plays at the federal level, that we could explain to the public that we're proud that we both oppose BDS at the state and local level, and move our campaign forward to focus on the issues that are of critical importance to the working families of Illinois: winning Medicare for all, winning affordable child care for working mothers, winning a $15 living wage now, and winning free college tuition for our students. But, you know, after so many days of conversation, it became clear that our difference of opinion on this issue would make it impossible to continue moving forward.
You know, the editorial board today from the Tribune tweeted out, like, at Daniel Biss saying, you know, you should have done a better job vetting this. I can't believe you missed this kind of thing. I mean, was this issue talked about at all when you were drafted to be the lieutenant governor candidate? Did the issue of Israel come up in conversation when you were chosen?
Yeah, so, you know, I've been consistent in my position. I was prepared to explain how I have consistently opposed BDS at the state and local level. I provided the campaign with the statements that I made in 2016 at the People Summit, which at that interview at the People Summit, I explained how I believe it's part of a conversation and that we should consider the role that the BDS movement plays at the federal level in exerting pressure to bring about a two-state solution.
Do you push back, Carlos, on the idea that you're being categorized, that you changed your position?
Absolutely. I have never been inconsistent on my position. For a number of years, in numerous public forums, I have espoused where I stand on this issue, and I'm sorry that the senator didn't understand those facts.
Well, so do you think that this means that he's basically locked up by a particular interest group and that he's not really willing to try and work on compromise?
I believe that in our own ways, Senator Biss and I are going to continue to fight for the central issues that were the things that brought me on this ticket. Medicare for all, free college tuition. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm focused on at this point.
How do we
continue to build that movement?
Carlos, do you find yourself, you know, being in this predicament, which is somewhat unusual predicament for politicians to have reverse course and be dropped from a ticket? Do you find yourself, you know, with your political movement and the progressives here in Chicago, do you find yourself looking at different candidates? Do you find yourself fighting for those issues outside of this race? What's the next move for you?
Yeah, so, you know, the movement that progressives are building across this country is a diverse movement that's bringing people together from all backgrounds to fight for issues of economic justice, to fight to ensure that we have a government that's formed by the people and not a rich and powerful few. And I'm committed to continue building that movement. I'm proud of the work I've done building that movement as a Chicago alderman. And that's exactly what I'm going to continue to focus on doing, is working with this broad array, with this diverse group, to move forward on these key issues that are impacting Chicagoans, that are impacting Illinois, that are impacting American working families. Now, as for who I'm going to be supporting, yeah, I will be supporting the candidate that's going to be most likely to deliver on those issues. That's going to give us Medicare for all, a $15 living wage today, affordable child care, and free college tuition.
What if that's Senator Biss? I mean, that's what he's running on. You said he's running on that himself. I mean, are you going to back him even though he dropped you?
Is that I'm going to be supporting the candidate most likely to deliver those things. And that's what I'm looking at right now in the field. But ultimately, like I said, the work to win those things is bigger than any one candidate. It's about a movement, and that's what I'm focused on moving forward, is building that movement.
So do you think that you and the Democratic Socialists of America would now be interested in supporting Amaya Pawar for governor?
Like I said, I want to see who's going to be most likely to deliver on those issues of social and economic justice. And I think that a lot of people are going to be looking long and hard at the candidates, just like I am, to see who's going to be most likely to deliver on those issues.
Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa, the former lieutenant governor candidate.
And now alderman from the 35th
ward. Alderman, back to being,
Now
you're back to being alderman. Boo-hoo, right? All right, Alderman, great. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a good night.
Mike Fouché in studio here on The Download. We talk to Mike every Wednesday, dailyline.net. All right, so we just had Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa on. What impact does it have? I mean, as you said right at the top, the idea that this is a precious time for all candidates because they have to get their signatures in by deadline, which is coming up soon here. The idea that what actual impact does it have on Senator Biss's campaign?
It's big. I mean, you know, these guys, they're at this point, what campaigns are trying to do is build momentum, and they're trying to demonstrate that they're moving forward and that they have a plan, and trying to let volunteers know that, you know, they got stuff going on. This stuff, you know, Pritzker, he's starting to, you know, gain some baggage with some of the stuff about Blagojevich and other things like that. And, you know, people are starting to say, you know, maybe Pritzker is not going to be the guy to do it. Maybe Biss is the guy. But now all of a sudden, you know, this is bad news.
Who does it help the most? Who does it help that the stumble in the Biss campaign?
Well, it certainly helps J.B. Pritzker. There's no question about that. But, you know, maybe it also helps Amaya Pawar. You know, Amaya Pawar and Biss really both going after the same group of Bernie voters. And I think if Amaya Pawar is able to gain some momentum from that, that's a huge deal. The advantage that Biss has had for a while is that he had like $1.3 million of cash left over from when he ran for comptroller in 2016, and he dropped out of the race.
Right.
So he always had a bunch of money, and he has a really good donor base, which on the North Shore, North Shore Jews, that's his main donor base because he represents that area as a state senator.
Does Senator Biss have to? I don't think he has to change his messaging, but I mean, he was kind of being, like you just mentioned, like the guy going after that Bernie vote. Well, dropping a Bernie delegate and changing course in the middle because of his stance, a stance that's pretty popular with the Bernie voters. I mean, what is it? I mean, it almost signals that Senator Biss, to stay in the race, has to think of a different course of action.
You know, the thing that it does is that it makes it very clear that Daniel Biss changed direction in a big way because of a particular interest group. And that's a terrible narrative. I mean, basically, you're no longer able to say, I'm a man for myself and I stand for my ideas. You're not able to do that anymore because everyone's going to point at this and says, well, what about that time?
Speaking of what about that time, as you mentioned with J.B. Pritzker, I mean, this seems to be the game plan or the blueprint for a Pritzker opposition, whether it be campaigns in the primary or the Republicans, is going to be his affiliation with Rod Blagojevich. We saw it earlier where Pritzker showed up on the FBI tapes. That was the first drop. Today, the Tribune reporting that a little quid pro quo, perhaps, when giving money to Blagojevich, and then Blagojevich turning around and giving money back to Pritzker interests. I mean, is this going to be the kind of thing that we see in this campaign where every month a new Blagojevich-Pritzker story gets dropped?
Probably. Or, you know, Pritzker giving money to some person that's not great or some organization that turned out to go bad later on. I mean, J.B. Pritzker was at the top of the list for every Democrat political fundraiser and, you know, a lot of charity organizations. And he wrote a lot of checks. I mean, he's been a guy that's given a lot of money, and people knew J.B. Pritzker was somebody who wrote checks more than the other Pritzkers. And so I'm sure that there's a lot of stuff out there that he's given to that has gone bad. You know, how would he know? I mean, you know, a lot of things happen over the years.
Right.
And it's not surprising that J.B. Pritzker back in the early aughts gave money to the Democratic governor.
But the idea of being, I mean, and I'm not suggesting there's any wrongdoing, but in the state of Illinois to be on FBI tapes or to have the inference of possible wrongdoing or not wrongdoing, but shady businesses where you give money and you get something in return. That's textbook sort of the Chicago way. And it can't look good for the Democratic leader who wants to do things differently.
It's one thing to hear that somebody was on the tape. It's another to actually listen to it. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, if somebody has that audio and it shows up in a TV commercial, zowie.
All right, so the only name we haven't mentioned, that's probably a good thing, is Chris Kennedy, the Democrat who, I mean, what's the chances that Chris Kennedy can take on the progressive mantle and be the guy who recruits the Bernie voter? I mean, he kind of has played around the edges, even though he's got the big traditional Democrat name.
You know, it's really weird. Chris Kennedy, you keep expecting at some point he's going to gain traction and something's going to happen, but it's not. And the announcement that he was going to be announcing his running mate later, and we still haven't heard anything. It's Wednesday, you know, okay. You know, so why don't you have anybody? And, you know, again, he's got the same problem that Biss has, which is, you know, he's got to get signatures and petitions. And that's a huge, huge undertaking. I've run those statewide campaigns. It's a lot of work.
Well, it's a great way to start. I mean, this is sort of the first week out to start this thing. Petitions are out, and I mean, we get news on the first Wednesday that we talk. The big story that nobody's talking about coming out of City Council today is a borrowing plan. More money being borrowed from Rahm Emanuel and the plan to move. We had the Treasurer Kurt Summers on last night talking about finances and where we are as a city of Chicago. And what does this mean to essentially put forth a borrowing strategy to the City Council?
Well, I mean, it's basically the mayor now has authority to borrow at a lower rate for certain types of bonds, which is a good thing for the city. The city is always borrowing. It's constantly borrowing, and it's not because it's getting deeper and deeper in debt, but it's because big municipalities always have a lot of bonds that they're rolling. And Chicago actually, unfortunately, has an exceptional amount of debt that's been carried over from the daily years. So this will be a way that they can borrow less money, or that the cost of borrowing will be less over time. But the other thing, though, is that the city of Chicago is going to have bigger and bigger costs over time because we've put out into the out years until 2049, we're going to be raising the amount of money that we have to pay into our pension funds.
Right.
And this is part of the deal that was cut
that's
a couple of years
about
back.
Last night,
when we just got started, remember you and I started on the radio? That's what we talked about all the time. And so, you know, this is going to be going on forever.
Mike Fouché from the Daily Line joins us every Wednesday to talk Chicago County and, of course, state politics. Mike, great to talk to you.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Stephanie Rogers is going to join us, musician, singer, songwriter. Story Jam is her live lit show she does. It's a brunch at the City Winery coming up this weekend. So we'll talk with Stephanie Rogers. Great to have her in. I don't think I've had her on the download. I've had her on different shows in my life, but not on this show. So it's great to be reunited with Stephanie tonight. Also, Wild Cloth Theater. A theater in Chicago celebrating its 10th anniversary, which its specialty is to put horror on stage. So we know the horror genre very well with film, but not necessarily on stage and in local theaters. So we'll talk with Wild Claw Theater, and also 10 o'clock tonight to swap meet. Greg Flam's back in the building. All right, well, coming up this Friday is the 2017 Risa K. Lambert Chicago Luncheon. It's a fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum at the Sheraton Hotel. It's one of the biggest fundraisers for the museum in the entire country. Over 2,000 people are expected, and the event's also expected to raise over $5 million. The luncheon is called What You Do Matters, and the keynote speaker is none other than Iranian-Canadian filmmaker, journalist, and human rights activist Mazyar Bahari. Bahari is well known for the story of being imprisoned in Iran. While covering the 2009 elections for Newsweek magazine, he was accused of being a spy and bearing witness to a crime. What does that mean? Well, it means Bahari was present in covering the violent street protests, and that was enough for authorities to put him in prison in solitary confinement, to torture him, and to coerce a false confession. He told his story in his memoir, Then They Came For Me, and that memoir was turned into the 2014 film Rosewater, which was produced by Jon Stewart. Even after that experience, Bahari continues to be a witness and to use his filmmaking as a tool for justice. He founded Journalism is Not a Crime, a project that sheds lights on the journalists that have been jailed in Iran. He also is the founder of Iran Wire, a citizen journalism news site. And his latest film is called Crime and Denial, a documentary focusing on Iranian regime's denial of the Holocaust. It's the only country in the world publicly to do so. It's my pleasure to welcome Mazyar Bahari to the big table tonight. Mazyar, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Very nice to be here.
Nice to meet you.
It's a little bit intimidating to be in the fishbowl with everyone looking into the studio, but I'll try my best to.
That's what the bright lights are for, right? There you go. So you're in town to do the keynote for this luncheon, a fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Museum.
Yes.
Big deal. But this is really about your work that you've done, and you've done it for your whole career, but to really sort of highlight some of the atrocities around the narrative. I mean, the Iranian regime's narrative of the Holocaust and denying the Holocaust ever existed is dumbfounding. I mean, it's one of these that continues to kind of go unchecked in our world. What is it about this story that attracted you to turn your lens towards it?
Well, I may be the first technically Muslim. I say technically Muslim because I'm from a Muslim background, but I'm not a practicing Muslim. I'm the first Muslim who's ever made a film about the Holocaust, of course, sympathetic to the Holocaust. In 1994, The Voyage of the St. Louis, which I made when I was studying in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, of course, like millions of other people, Holocaust is one of the worst tragedies of modern history or history of mankind, and we have to learn a lot from that tragedy. We have to learn a lot from what led to Hitler's rise to power. We have to learn about the collaborators of the Nazi regime in different countries. And we have to make the lessons of Holocaust somehow relevant to our time.
Right.
So I tried to do that in 1994. As you remember, there were many Haitian refugees coming to this country at that time. And then, as now, many people were saying that these people are criminals and they are carrying diseases and they should be banned. And of course, 20 years later, many of those Haitian refugees, now very successful American citizens, and even Republican candidate Donald Trump went to Little Haiti last year and said that I'm very proud of the Haitian community and I'm very supportive of the Haitian community. I'm not sure what Donald Trump would say in 1994 when the Haitians were trying to come to this country.
Yeah, so, it's all about perspective. I mean, you see it over and over in politics. It's just perspective. Yeah,
but I think the lesson of the Holocaust, the lesson that we have to learn from the Holocaust is not to repeat the history or not allow the history to be repeated. And I think it's up to us as individuals to do that. And I think it's my duty as a human being, first of all, but also as a journalist and filmmaker to raise awareness about the Holocaust.
I mean, for you, and it's such an interesting story because the idea of, it's not just one, I mean, I guess it's all one regime, but Iranian regimes over time have continued this, and it continues today, this denial that it ever existed. And it seems to be much more about propaganda or political advantage or anything in that area than it is about sort of washing history. But I mean, how do you get through to an Iranian population, mostly Muslim, that's only heard one story from their regime for years and years and years, to provide them facts and to say the rest of the world believes or doesn't believe, knows, has these facts in front of them?
To start with, we have to understand that anti-Semitism is a Western phenomenon. And Iranian anti-Semites and Holocaust deniers, they are using Western anti-Semitic literature, works of David Irving, Roger Garrity, and people like that. So you have to somehow dissect the Holocaust denial for people of Iran. And fortunately, we are living in the era of social media and when there are lots of digital media, satellite media, and we can communicate with people inside Iran from the outside. Maybe what I'm doing now would not be possible 20 years ago before the advent of the internet and social media. But now you can communicate with people directly in Iran. So you look at the facts. You give people the facts. In the film that we made about the Holocaust, we talked to Holocaust survivors. One of them was in Auschwitz. There is a picture of her in Auschwitz. So if you don't want to believe her words, you're in denial. You're in denial of history.
The film you did, the Crime and Denial film, that is not for me. I mean, I understand. I saw exactly. it. I'm like, well, this is something that I've learned from the get-go in yeah. America about this. This is really for Iranian Muslim population that's never seen these pictures, never seen or heard this narrative.
Exactly. I think we have to have a new approach to educating Holocaust and to Holocaust education all around the world, because what may be needed in schools in America, with all the free media and many Holocaust films available to people, is different from some countries in the Middle East in different languages. So what we tried to do was to find the areas that the Iranian government talks about, and also sometimes do the myth busting in terms of Aryan nations, for example, yeah. because the Iranian government, on one hand, it calls itself Muslim and it calls itself the motherland of Muslim nations and supports the Palestinian causes. But at the same time, it calls itself a part of the Aryan race. You know, Iran means the land of Aryans. And even Ahmadinejad, in I think it was about 10 years ago, wrote a letter to Angela Merkel saying that Iran and Germany, as two Aryan countries, have to cooperate with each other.
What a contrast.
It's just idiotic. It's, you know, to tell you the truth, much of what I do is for selfish reasons, because I don't want to be ashamed of being Iranian. And Iran is not this government. Iran is not Ahmadinejad or Ayatollah Khamenei. Iran is a country that has hosted Jews for 2,500 years. Iranian king, Persian king, Cyrus the Great, is called the Messiah in the Bible. And Iranian diplomats during the Second World War helped Iranian Jews and non-Iranian Jews. Yeah. And Iran hosted hundreds of Jewish refugees or thousands of refugees during the Second World War. So that is the Iran that I want to represent, and that's the image of that Iran that I want to show.
Well, let's continue to talk about that image of Iran. We're talking with Maziar Bahari, the Iranian-Canadian filmmaker, journalist, human rights activist. He's the keynote speaker at a fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. This Friday, it's a luncheon, the 2017 Risa K. Lambert Chicago Luncheon. It's at the Sheraton Hotel. It's going to be called What You Do Matters. It's coming up on Friday. Maziar Bahari, my guest tonight at the big table. Let's take a break. Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, longtime filmmaker, journalist, human rights activist, Maziar Bahari. His memoir, which is Then They Came For Me, was made into the 2014 film Rosewater, which was produced by Jon Stewart. It was a story of covering the 2009 elections in Iran and found himself in an Iranian prison for the better part of 2009 for bearing witness to crime. I mean, am I saying that right? The bearing witness to a crime? I mean, is that
the... Well, it was a very complicated scenario that the Revolutionary Guards who arrested me, even they didn't know what was going on. Their initial idea was to incriminate a group of people within the Iranian government, the reformists, through my confessions. So as I mentioned in the book, my interrogations were really not about what I did,
right,
but they were forcing me to say what they wanted me to say.
They needed a narrative. They needed to say that the Western journalists were corrupting
exactly.
the street protests. They're the ones causing these protests.
That the Western journalists, the people who work for Western media, they are spies. And they are, you know, that the Western media is part of the intelligence apparatus of the United States. And I think they look at the Iranian government and many of the news agencies in Iran, many the television, radio television, it's according to the constitution, yeah. it has to be a state radio television. And many of the newspapers, they belong to Revolutionary Guards or different branches of the government. So they think that it's the same situation in the United States. The idea of free press does not mean anything to them.
And I want to get to we'll talk about free press and the idea of what's happening in this country and sort of the vilifying of the president.
What is happening?
Right. But I want to watch the movie this morning, just Rosewater, and one of the striking scenes, and it's accurate from the memoir, is the idea of your interrogator having a sort of stereotype of what Americans were like. I mean, he was trying to paint you out to be a sympathizer. He was trying to get you to confess that you were you were doing illicit Western things. I mean, but really, with the thing we pull out of that scene is that the idea of what America is. I mean, even the clip where he pulls up a clip from The Daily Show. You were on The Daily Show, and says, "What is this? I don't understand. This says you're a spy," which you could tell from the joke. I mean, there's a lot of misunderstanding that's happening.
Exactly. Before I was arrested, I was interviewed by The Daily Show, and the correspondent, the quote-unquote correspondent, Jason Jones, pretended to be a spy. And the interrogator didn't find it very funny. I mean, didn't understand the humor. So he thought that he had an evidence that I had met a spy. So why a spy would be filming a meeting? That was,
irrelevant
for him. He just thought that he had an evidence. So I think bigotry, I think zealotry and ignorance is not the really monopoly of one nation or the other. I mean, I was just watching the images of Charlottesville the other day, and, you know, those people, what they did was repulsive, but they also looked really repulsive. And they were just saying, "Jews will not replace us." And I was just thinking that I don't know of any Jew who want to replace you guys specifically. I mean, I know many Jewish people, and I don't know many of them who want to live in trailer parks, or you want to have, you know, a relationship with their sisters. It's just that they don't want to choose. I think if I were a Jew looking at those images, I would say, I don't want to replace you.
But it is interesting. You know, I mean,
my interrogator is an Iranian version of those guys in Charlottesville.
You know, it's interesting because I think between these two countries, America and Iran, there's a lot of misunderstanding. I think that we get all of our... I can only speak for myself. I'm even a talk show host. I'm well-read. I'm paying attention to stuff. But I get my stuff from what the president says, or the State Department says, or what the newspaper might write about. I have an understanding of Iran is that they hate Americans, that they hate Israel, that they are, if I listen to President Trump, a threat to the Western world. Mm-hmm. You know, and even right before we went to the break, you talk about just sort of wanting to represent Iran and the culture in the right way. You know, I mean, do you see that in your travels? I mean, the idea that Americans are as guilty as Iranians are when it comes to sort of typecasting the countries?
I think it's a very complex issue. I think some of it has to do with the nature of media, and some of it has to do with the nature of the 24-hour cycle of media, that they have to report the first thing that comes to their mind. So when they see Ahmadinejad denying the Holocaust, they report that. They don't have the time even to research and go back to, Iranian history, even Iranian recent history, that Iranians helped Jews and, you know, they portray Iran as an anti-Semitic nation. But, you know, there are other publications, I don't know, New Yorker or New York Review of Books, that do a more in-depth material. But how many people read New Yorker or New York Review of Books compared to CNN or Fox News? And I think it's in a similar vein, it's the same thing in Iran, that the Iran state media, radio and television portray America and Israel as the great Satan and the not so great Satan. And many people are brainwashed. But I think it's, and I have to emphasize on the role of the individual, which is really the message of this launch as well, that, you know, that we as individuals, we have to do our best to inform other people. And we have to use this opportunity now. We have the social media. Each person can be a medium himself or herself. And we have to use social media in order to enlighten people, to tell people the truth. And, you know, and also I think that I have to portray a different image of Iran as much as possible, because Iran is really not a country that this government represents.
Yeah, and I mean, I mean, the problem is with the memoir and the film. I mean, you're talking about things that are right up America's alley. This idea that you're imprisoned wrongly, you know, for freedoms that we have here in the country, and you don't in Iran. So it almost plays to that in this way that, I mean, when watching Rosewater today, I was like, yeah, I'm glad that can't happen to me. I mean, it can in America, but I'm glad. I mean, I automatically think that this is some far off place.
Also, the other thing that I want to tell people about the Holocaust is that the Holocaust, the tragedy, one of the tragedies of Holocaust is this cost of discrimination, cost of discriminating against Jews in Germany. When you think about the contribution of the Jewish community to humanity, to civilizations all around the world, and when you think about the potential that those 6 million people had in Europe to contribute to their societies, it's just mind-boggling what the Nazis deprived Europe and generations of people of. And I think, again, in Iran, there are many people who are discriminated against. We are not very far from the Baha'i Temple, which is north of Chicago in Wilmette. And the Baha'is of Iran are denied of, which is, for people who don't know, it's the largest religious minority. It's a new religion. And the Baha'is are denied of the right to education, the right of employment. And the Baha'is are forced to come outside of Iran. And there are many successful doctors, Baha'i doctors and engineers who live in the U.S., Canada, or many different places in Europe. And they're contributing to that society. But they love Iran. And they would have loved to go back to Iran and serve their country. So one of the things that I like to tell Iranian people, and also the Iranian government, is this cost of discrimination. Yeah. That discriminating against any group not only causes damage to that specific group, but also to all. And I think in this country, in the United States, that is very relevant.
Well, it's happening. I mean, we see it play out on the discrimination in Chicago, and we see it happening in the cost of segregation. We've talked about segregation in this time. So, I mean, there's similar things happening in different countries, but the same sort of human issues that we all can relate to.
And going back to the Holocaust, and that's why the Holocaust and the lessons of Holocaust is so important. We have to learn it, and we have to teach it as much as possible.
Let's do this. Let's take a break so we get tonight's news, and we'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Maziar Bahari, the Iranian-Canadian filmmaker, journalist, human rights activist, is the keynote speaker at the What You Do Matters luncheon, the Risa K. Lambert Chicago luncheon fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. It's going to be at the Sheraton Hotel on Friday lunchtime. We will continue our conversation with Maziar Bahari right after the news here on The Download. Stay with us. All right, thanks, Rob. This is The Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Maziar Bahari, the Iranian-Canadian filmmaker, journalist, human rights activist. He's got a litany of things that he's up to, a ton of projects, including being the keynote speaker here in Chicago for the Risa K. Lambert Chicago Luncheon, the fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. It's going to be at the Sheraton Hotel on Friday. The biggest fundraiser for the museum in the entire country.
It is.
It's amazing to think about. I mean, because this is for the National Museum in D.C.
Washington.
But
yes.
they come to Chicago and they say over 2,000 people expected, over $5 million raised coming up here on Friday.
Yes, it's a very important event. And I'm really honored to be the keynote speaker.
I mean, it is interesting because, I mean, you are Muslim. I mean, you're not, as you mentioned earlier, not practicing in religion.
Technically but, Muslim.
And you know, in 1994, you did the documentary on the Holocaust. And that actually came
St.
up
Louis,
in the interrogation. The Iranian guard, the Revolutionary Guard, they said, why, you're a sympathizer?
Yeah.
They questioned why you were involved in it. It actually worked against you. In that case,
basically what happened was that the film The Voyage of the St. Louis, which was the story of a group of Jewish immigrants who were supposed to come to the U.S. and Canada, and then they were denied entry and went back to Europe, and many of them died during the Holocaust. I made that film, and when the film was shown all around the world, and whenever I was doing interviews for the film, I was saying that one of the reasons that I'm doing this film is that I want to tell the world that not all Iranians are fanatic Muslims, and there are some Iranians who care about others. And in 1994, you remember that it was only a decade after the hostage taking, so there was a really, really negative media attention to Iran. So fast forward 20 years later when I was arrested in Iran in 2009, 15 years later when I was arrested in Iran in 2009, my interrogator showed me those interviews and said that, you know, you're a Zionist sympathizer and you're an Israeli spy trying to infiltrate into our government.
The story that was made into the movie Rosewater and as well as part of your memoir was in 2009 covering the election in Iran and the protests, the subsequent protests afterwards. You were arrested on saying that they accused you of being a spy. You were...
Not a spy, they told me. I mean, this is how ridiculous it was that the first day they said that you're spying for four different spy agencies, the CIA, the British MI6, the Israeli Mossad, and Newsweek. And I said, do you mean Newsweek, the magazine?
The magazine
they
I
said,
work for.
No, there is no magazine. It's a part of the intelligence apparatus.
In that more, I mean, it's explained well in the film and in the memoir as well, but here, talk about that. I mean, for you to be in that position where this is different than, it's interesting, we had somebody on earlier in the week yesterday who talking about his experience of being wrongly incarcerated in Brooklyn. And working for legal, you know, lawyers trying to help him out and holding out hope. In your case, in famed prison in Iran, take us back to 2009. Are you optimistic that this will be figured out, that this is, they got the wrong guy, I'm not a spy? Are you smart enough to know in that moment that this could be the end of your life?
The thing is that when you go to a solitary confinement, the whole purpose of being in solitary confinement is to deprive you of all your senses. You cannot see anything except for the walls around you. You cannot touch anything except for the walls around you. So you really feel numb and you start to hallucinate and you become vulnerable. You become vulnerable to your interrogator because he's the only person between you and the outside world. And he basically is in charge of your life. So there were moments that I was really suicidal in a sense. I was really depressed. And also when you are in Evin prison in Iran, when you know that thousands of innocent people have died there, their threat that they're going to kill you is just not a, you know.
Not just a threat.
Just not a threat. It comes in the context of that history.
In the memoir and the film, you talk about that. The conflict of wanting to stay true to the truth, and you're a journalist, you're not a spy, and wanting to get out, and you know, that's all they want. They were saying, we can get out of here if you just go in front of the cameras and say that you're helping out the Western world and you caused all these protests, you and others. Yeah. I mean, at a certain point, you had to make that decision.
Exactly. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book and I worked with Jon Stewart to make the film was to tell the truth about journalism, that yes, there are some journalists who are not doing their job, but there are many people in different professions who are not doing their jobs. There are many doctors or lawyers, whatever. But there are thousands of journalists all around the world who are endangering their lives in order to inform people. The Nazis called journalists the lying press, the fake news. And what are we hearing now from some people in this country and in Europe as well? They call journalists who are doing their jobs, who are endangering their lives, fake news as well. And I think it's, again, going back to the Holocaust where we started, it is very important to understand the value of information, of correct information, and informing people, and the fact that you have to just tell people the truth and try to give people the facts and figures as much as possible.
But you do this with also Journalism Not a Crime. I mean, you have been at the front lines of this fight where you have said, hey, I will tell the truth regardless of what government wants from me or wants me to do. I mean, to the point of putting yourself in harm's way. I mean, there's a scene in the film where, you know, they say, you really want to do this? You know, in the next moment, you're in solitary confinement. This idea, there's a difference between sort of, you know, running into harm's way and another in sort of doing this job and being able to deliver the facts in this way in which there are some countries and some parts of this world that just don't honor freedom of the press.
Well, you know, every profession comes with a hazard. This is part of the professional hazard that, you know, if you're a firefighter and you're fighting fires, you know, small fires on a regular basis, maybe for 20 years, and then you're confronting a big fire, you, as a firefighter, as a professional firefighter, you have to do that. It's the same thing with journalism, that you're working as a journalist, you try to give people the truth. And sometimes there is a bigger truth that you feel responsible to do that. So I think I'm very lucky as well that I had that attention paid to me, because I was working for Newsweek, which at that time belonged to Washington Post Company. So some people knew my name. I had friends and colleagues outside of Iran who had an amazing, who staged an amazing campaign for me. But many of my friends inside Iran and other parts of the world, they do not have attention. They're not as lucky as I was. So again, when I came out of prison, I thought it was my responsibility to do something for those people, to give those numbers. Because when we hear that, for example, I don't know, 60 journalists are in prison in Turkey, 50 journalists are in prison in Iran, 40 journalists in China. These are not numbers. These are people with families, with loved ones, with histories. So what we try to do in the campaign that you mentioned, Journalism is Not a Crime, is to give a face and a biography to these numbers and make people care about them.
Mazar, has it changed? I mean, in 2017, I mean, this story was 2009, but I mean, you've been dealing with this for your entire journalistic career. Do you see in 2017 that countries and authoritarians and others are having a different look at journalists, or is it getting worse?
I think it's getting worse, because when I was working, I worked in a lot in Iraq in between 2003 and 2007. And there was always danger that you could be kidnapped and you could be accidentally kidnapped or you could be accidentally shot. But now it has changed. Journalists have become targets in many countries. ISIS is making journalists a target in many different countries, even in some democracies. When you look at the number of whistleblowers in different countries who've been arrested, you see that journalists have become targets. I think with the explosion of this, of digital media, with all the information around us, I think intelligence organizations, governments do not know what to do. And the most expedient thing to do is to resort to the old, same old methods of arrest and incarceration and interrogations. And of course, in this country or in other democratic countries, there is a system of checks and balances. But in countries like Egypt, in Eritrea, Ethiopia, China, Russia, they're targeting journalists. In Iran, it's the same thing.
You see now in the United States of America, and you living in London, being in the States as well. I mean, getting this opportunity to see how journalism is being viewed, not only from the government, but from the people coming up and hashtags, not believing the media, not believing journalists, the profession, if you put it on the list of the top, you know, it's always at the bottom. I mean, do you see in a country that honors freedom of the press, is it really freedom of the press?
I think there is a freedom of press, of course, in the United States. There is a very high level of freedom of press. But I think people are very disillusioned with institutions, and they see different media organizations as part of these institutions as well. And as such, they look at the different institutions such as Washington Post, New York Times, CNN, with the same disdain that they look at bigger companies like ExxonMobil or IBM or, Chase Manhattan Bank. So I think people are just not very trustful of institutions. And that's why we are going to citizen journalists in the site that we have, iranwire.com. That's both, it's both in both languages, Persian and English. We go to citizen journalists in Iran and we ask them to report to us. And we try to gain some trust by doing that, because I think people just don't believe in big institutions anymore. And it's a positive phenomenon, and at the same time, it's a negative phenomenon. It's a positive phenomenon because it is giving people, it is giving the sense, that self-confidence to people that they have rights as citizens of different countries to right. express themselves, and they have certain sets of rights as citizens of the countries that they have to fight to gain those rights. But at the same time, it makes people in different countries, individuals in different countries, vulnerable to demagogues, to people who just through populist promises, they just mobilize a group of people and then they take over power.
Right.
And I think we've been to a country that something like that happened. I'm not sure what it is, but
well,
yeah.
Mazir, I'm, we'll wrap up here, but when you look back on your life, especially the experience in 2009 in prison in Iran for being accused of being a spy, how has that changed not only your personal life, but your professional life? How have you changed as a journalist from that experience?
I think I've become more of an activist journalist, because I think the attention that was paid to me through the campaign and through the book and the film, etc., it has given me a new audience, and I think I have a responsibility, and I cannot be just a neutral journalist anymore. And I've become an activist, and I somehow enjoy that role because there are not that many people who can do that. And, you know, it's made my life a bit more difficult, but at the same time, when you're in a solitary confinement, you see how limited your life is, that you have a very limited amount of time in this world, and you have to use that as good as possible. And I think I've become a better person because of that horrible experience.
Iranian Canadian filmmaker, journalist, and human rights activist Mazyar Bahari is the keynote speaker at the upcoming 2017 Risa K. Lambert Chicago Luncheon. It is a fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, the Sheraton Hotel, on Friday afternoon. One of the biggest, fundraiser for the museum in the entire country. Over 2,000 people expected the event, also expected to raise over $5 million. Mazyar, it's great to meet you. Great to hear your story. And thank you for coming in and talking to us about
it. It was great to be in the fishbowl and with everyone looking at us. It was great talking to you. Thank you so much.
All right. Good conversation there, Mazyar Bahari. Yeah, I had not read the memoir, but I had not seen the movie Rosewater. Have you seen it, Pete? Did you see it? It's amazing to me to think, and it's hard sometimes, especially from the human experience, to imagine something that people do every single day here in the United States: cover a protest, put a camera on a protest down Michigan Avenue, and that can lead you to be interrogated, tortured, thrown in solitary confinement, and essentially coerced. I mean, this isn't a period piece. This was 2009. Remember 1973. I mean, this just happened. But it is fascinating too, because I do think that we're getting somewhere when we talk about trying to understand people, because to be in a situation where, and it's kind of, they kind of get into it in the movie, but this idea of their stereotype, the interrogator in Iran's stereotype of Americans, and then we have our stereotypes of Iranians, right? And this idea that it's all served from some sort of conglomerate media company that's telling us what we should know. You know what I mean? If it's on our end, it could be the big companies that were mentioned saying, here's what you need to know about the politics in Iran, or the president or the State Department or our 24/7 news cycle telling us just sort of the headlines, just what we need to know. And in Iran, I mean, they're talking about MTV and other places where that's what that sort of paints a picture, the Daily Show. To be able to look at a clip from The Daily Show, and he goes, you're talking to a spy, aren't you? No, that's not a spy. That's a comedian playing a spy. Why would they do that? I mean, the concept of context. Yeah, it blows your mind. But yeah, and also it also blows my mind that the biggest fundraiser for the U.S. Holocaust Museum, a huge museum in Washington, D.C., is right here in Chicago. I didn't know that. It's the first I knew about that. So there you go. You learn something every day. All right, coming up, we've got a great 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock hour. Coming up at 10 o'clock, you'll love this, Pete. So I once again forgot my daily posters. If you're a regular listener to the Swap Meet, you know that I have been for the last month talking about these cool daily posters that I have from Richard M. Daley running for mayor. I think it was 1983, the one he lost. So I was like, but this time around, I remembered that I forgot them, and I texted my wife, and I said, take a picture of them. They're sitting in the garage. So she took a picture, and they are from 1983. It says, Richard Daley, it's time for leadership. And it's a picture of a young, maybe slightly unshaven Richard M. Daley. He's going for a hip look. She also took a picture and added the, I have a framed 8x10 photo of Mike Dicka flipping off a camera. That's classic. Everybody's got that, right? But I had that framed at some point. It was up on the wall, the Schadenfreude office when you came in. That was like, he's in his full Bears regalia. Like, he's just like, you know, in a pregame. And he gets a nice little flip in the bird. They should put that on a post. That should be a post. It probably is a poster, right? I would think that that's exactly where you'd want. So I have the pictures. So at least I can show Greg. I have the pictures. Are these worth anything? This is political propaganda from 1983. Maybe I'll put them up on Facebook or is that, I don't know where the kids are putting stuff up now. I'm going to find where the kids are putting, I'm going to Snapchat this. And I'm going to be like, hey, take a look at this cool Mayor Daley poster. And be like, get out of here. You can't be on our social media channel. Get out. You're not allowed. Dad. I'll be like, it's cool. It's Mayor Daley. It's ironic. No. You've got to go. You're going to ruin this for us. Just like you ruined Facebook and Twitter. Get. You're the one who ruined Friendster. Now get out of here. My generation's on the hook for ruining all social media. I feel like the generation, I'm 43, so I feel like we were the ones that were like, not really the early, Facebook wasn't really for us, but we adapted it and like mainstreamed it.
Yeah.
Then our parents got on it. So we're like the gentrifiers of social media.
I'm always, whenever I follow somebody new on Twitter or whatever, I look at somebody's profile, I always look to see when they joined Twitter and to see and how it relates to when I joined, because I wasn't that early of an adopter, but I worked for somebody who was an early adopter, so like by choice you kind of had to be, you know. Right. So I always enjoy when like somebody that has like, you know, a million followers, I'm like, what, you just joined in 2010?
Next you're gonna tell me you only email people who got invites to Gmail. Remember that was the thing where you got an invite to Gmail?
No.
Like early on, it was invite only. You had to get an invite to Gmail. It's all bogus, but the idea, like, that's how exclusive it was.
I remember because I had a work email address that I used pretty much predominantly as my sole email. And then when I left that job, I had to just use, like, my Gmail account. And, like, my Gmail account was, like, Cubs are great, you know, 1971 or something. You know,
I think, like, I had a 2003, a J. Coffs, a 2003.
It was like, if you're going to be looking for jobs and stuff, you can't have a Cubs are great email address.
All right, coming up here, 9 o'clock hour. We got some great stuff coming up. Wild Claw Theater is going to be here, and also Stephanie Rogers up next here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 9:30, Josh DeGoren is going to join us, the artistic director of Wild Claw Theater. Wild Claw is the, I think it's the only, I mean, Josh will tell us, theater company in Chicago, at least, that is dedicated to putting the horror genre on stage. They've been doing it for 10 years. They do this great show called Death Scribe, which is a radio play of horror, like horror genre radio plays. Lincoln Hall, other places, they do it every year. So we'll talk with Josh. They're celebrating their 10th anniversary. Got a new show. We'll talk about horror on stage. Dun, dun, dun. It's coming up 9:30. Well, this Sunday, head on over to the City Winery in the West Loop for the latest installment of Story Jam, the live lit show that brings the best Chicago storytellers together with the best Chicago musicians. The combination makes for one of the more unique performances in Chicago as musicians create original music based off the stories that are featured. It's the brainchild of musician Stephanie Rogers. She's been a fixture in Chicago for years. She got her own record label, Hip Chick Records. You can see her performing all over town, but these days she's pretty much doing Story Jam. Like I said, Story Jam will be on stage starting at 11 a.m. on Sunday at the City Winery in the West Loop. Stephanie Rogers, welcome to The Download. Good to see you.
Hey, Justin. Thanks for having me.
It's been a long time. Yeah,
I
feel like the last time we spoke was about 5 years ago, but good to follow you on Facebook, things like that. So good to see you.
Thank you.
So let's talk about Story Jam, because this is something that is different than the sort of musician shows you've done in the past. Where does the idea of Story Jam come from?
I think that I did do the musician shows for a while, but I came from a theater background originally, studied theater at Northwestern, got through that program, loved every minute of it, and then this show is sort of like a melding of music and theater and being a little bit the quirky thing that I tend to be on stage. It all sort of comes together in this show, so I sort of feel like it's my calling right now.
You know, it's an interesting, because I think about a lot of times you have live lit shows when you put storytellers on stage. They're almost always produced by storytellers or produced by, you know, people who might be of the same genre or the same discipline. It's interesting because this idea is really sort of a combination, because, as you said, you have a theater background, but you really come at this as a musician.
That for sure. I was going to a lot of storytelling shows, actually, in Chicago. There are gazillion, bazillion. Actually, Josh Zagorin, who you're going to have on next, he did a Story Jam, and I found him at a storytelling show in Chicago. And I'm like, dude, you've got to come to my show, too. So I'm going to all of these storytelling events. But I was noticing that something was missing from them for me. Sometimes they'll have music. They might have like some cool banjo music or some interlude music, intermission music. But nobody was combining, making them work together, the music and the stories. So I thought, that's something I could do. I jumped right in. I take the stories. They send me their stories. Josh sent me his story a little late, though, I have to say. But he did send me a story eventually.
We'll deal with that when we see Josh in the hallway.
I'd like to talk to him about that when I see him in the lobby. But I get the stories ahead of time, and then I just use them as a jumping off point to write songs for this big band. It's a 10-piece band.
Wow.
But I'm sitting at home writing the songs and kind of highlighting little pieces.
How much time do you give yourself to do that?
Oh, gosh, it takes forever sometimes. Sometimes I could spend a week on one darn song if it's just not coming along. But then sometimes, like last night, I wrote a song for Sunday's show. Now, as you can tell, sometimes I'm a little late. It's not just Josh's fault. But I wrote a song last night in like 10 minutes, and it just comes pouring out. So you know how the creative process is.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by it, because a 10-piece band, there's amazing spectacle to that. And the idea of having that presented in the program just does take it out of sort of a regular live lit type show. But it also is a lot of rehearsal, a lot of arrangement, a lot of, you know, 10 people on stage with the performance. I mean, talk about that process, because I would assume, tonight you came up with you finished this song, that's great, but you've got to get these 10 musicians in line as well. I mean, there's a lot of pre-production that goes into something like that.
Yeah, you're so right. There is a ton of pre-production, but actually it's sort of on the fly. for Story Jam, because we don't have time to rehearse. We do have, we sort of run the songs 1 hour before the show every single time. There's not an arduous, laborious rehearsal process at all. And it's sort of like doing improv. It's like, boom, get out there and go. And hopefully you've prepared enough in the years you've studied music, and hopefully I've done a good enough job giving them, you know, enough information. I give them a recording of the song, so I have to make sure that all my ducks are in a row.
Right, right.
And then they can kind of, they read the music, and they, and I say, okay, this one's going to have a hip-hop feel. Go. And hopefully it comes out okay. That's what, I think, you know, the lack of sort of need for preparation also gives it that same kind of urgency and excitement that, you know, you and I love as you know, personalities.
Well, let's do this. Let's listen to it, because you have a selection that you brought in from the last Story Jam.
Mm-hmm.
So set this up for us. This is, so the idea, what makes Story Jam different is that a story will be told, and then you and the band perform original music based on the story that was just told.
Yes.
That's the idea, right?
That's exactly right. Right.
So set this one up. What are we hearing?
Okay, well, this is a guy named Archie Jamjohn. He's probably one of the top storytellers in Chicago, very well known, has won awards. Everybody loves Archie. He's charming as heck. He told a story about his cat, JJ, but he just used JJ as a front for the real story, which was talking about addiction, his family, more serious issues. He did it in a very funny and adorable way. And then I took a song that I wrote a song called Thai Cat for him, which also is it's a little bit about his cat, but it's a nod and it's a jumping off point. I'm a little bit poking fun at his use of a cat in his story.
All right, well, let's hear it. Here is a selection from Story Jam, which will be on stage, a different story and a different song on Sunday at City Winery. But here's from the last Story Jam with Stephanie Rogers.
So I was a somewhat lonely kid growing up. While I wasn't exactly an outcast, my parents told my sister and I that American kids were dangerous, and they had sneaky and underhanded ways of keeping them from us. For example, if I was invited to a birthday party, my father would scoff at the idea of buying a present. It is their birthday. Why I have to pay? And so on more than one occasion, I was sent to a friend's birthday with pieces of our home decor as a present. As in, happy birthday, James. Here's a hand-woven wicker basket. It was made by mountain people in Thailand. So I was not that popular. I did have a friend, though. I had a best friend. I had a cat. I had a cat named JJ. And JJ wasn't just any cat, he was a Siamese cat, which meant he was Thai, like my family. See, we'd had a couple cats before, but they had run away. And my mom explained this was an American problem. No Thai cat would run away. American cat run away because they wild, like American people. Oh, but Thai cat's so loyal, so love you, just like Thai wife. We would cross that bridge later.
You can snap or something.
I have no impending wife, no picket fence in sight. Lately, I don't even know where I go at night. All the potential we waste, all the self-loathing and hate. Wasted negativity, feeling like it's too late. I can't recover. Lover. I got a Siamese cat as like an acrobat with a pelvic thrust and a penchant for lust. I'm his victim, as loyal as a tie, waiting for me to die. I'm on a binge, but I'm feeling unhinged. I'm a kitty bitch. I can't recover.
There you go, a little clip right there. That was great. Thanks. We don't have enough clips on this show to download. More clips. Stephanie Rogers.
I'll get you clips.
Bringing the clips from Story Jam. Story Jam is going to be on stage at a live lit show that includes music, inspired original music from Stephanie and her band in the moment. That is on stage at the City Winery in West Loop Sunday, the early show, 11 o'clock a.m.
Yes, we hit it at noon, actually. We're doing a brunch show. It's something different. They tend to have their storytelling shows occur at brunch because like guys like Art Garfunkel are playing at night. So, yeah. You know, they do storytelling.
I just thought it was because you, of all these years, you just said, all right, you know what? I'm not doing the 11 o'clock shows at night anymore. 11 a.m. or nothing.
That's probably true, too.
That's how I feel. I whenever I do comedy shows, I'm like, is there any way to do this at 2 p.m.?
Yeah, I was in a band called Brother Brother for a little while Matt Spiegel.
Right.
Be friends with him. And we had a gig that started at midnight, but actually it was never midnight. It was always like 12:45 1. And I had a little baby at home, and I was like hauling out there every Sunday night. It was so brutal.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because does the live lit kind of show, I mean, there's a lot of organization and arrangement and producing that goes into it, but does it still serve that creative muscle that you somewhat leave behind with that 12:45 in the morning kind of, you know, rock show that in Brother Brother or other bands that you've been involved in?
I think the only thing it leaves behind is like the whiskey and the cigarettes. Other than that, though, I'm pretty, I feel like this is a creative endeavor, because it is so like, okay, here's some stories. We're going to throw these stories at you. This week I have seven songs to write.
Wow.
In the last kind of 10 days. That's a lot of work. And to make them all sound a little bit different, because I don't want to have, you know, seven country
songs.
It's
a different muscle, too, because a lot of times you'll record or you'll write and do all that stuff at the beginning of the process. And then when you're doing shows, you already know the songs that you're going to produce or you're going to perform that night.
Yeah, if you remember them, that's the trick. It's like, oh, well, how did that one go again?
Right.
Hopefully you remember it. But I think that This show is cool for me creatively, because it combines everything I love to do. I'm hosting the show, I'm producing the show, I have to organize stuff. It's stretching me in a lot of ways. I mean, it's cool, because for a while I did rocker thing in clubs with a lot of hairspray, lots of cans of hairspray, not very earth friendly back then. And then I did like the wedding scene, event music for a long time with a 12-piece orchestra. That was cool. But that didn't, you know, I didn't have my stamp on those projects as much as I do, you know, with this show. And sometimes we play, like this week, this show, I'm going to surprise the band and ask them to do an impromptu song. And I'm just going to give them a feel.
Don't give it away.
I can't tell everything, of course. But
Stephanie, it's interesting, too, the evolution of, you know, and not to get too deep on being a musician, being an artist. But the idea of what you just mentioned, I mean, the idea of going through styles and moments and scenes and different points in your life as a musician to be where you're at now. I mean, explain that arc. I mean, is this how the natural evolution of what you thought your music career was going to be like? The idea that you'd end up with something like Story Jam that you have all this creative control over?
I had no idea. I thought I was going to be a movie star living in the south of France. It didn't work out.
Good, okay.
But I'm happy that...
It's not over yet. There's still plenty of time.
Listen, I'm still waiting. Yeah. My day is coming. But I think that... I had no idea this. I didn't even know this existed. I didn't know live storytelling. I don't even know if it was as much a thing as it is now. There are storytellers from... They call them the old, you know, the old classic traditional storytellers. That's a whole crew of people.
Yeah.
This new kind of phase of storytelling that sort of comes out of the moth. This is a kind of format that we didn't know about when I was studying theater at Northwestern. I had no idea that this was going to be such a popular, cool thing to be involved with. So who knows what's next? But I think that this is, you know, I was hoping for an acting career, to be honest. I moved to Los Angeles and I did some commercials, little parts in movies. And then I realized that I didn't like Los Angeles. I probably wasn't very good at acting. And It was a desperate, lonely pursuit, really.
Well, I mean, it is interesting because that is known to be a solitary, lonely pursuit, not unlike stand-up comedy, the same concept.
Totally.
Music is different. Music is communal. Music is you play with bandmates, you get on stage, there's a lot of people around you at all times. Because, so it's not I guess it's not that surprising that you gravitated to that part of your creative life because it has all the things that acting doesn't.
That's so true. And also just songwriting itself is like writing your own script every single day. Hanging with the band is fun. I don't know if you've hung out with a lot of bands.
Sure.
But they're pretty cool. It's fun to be the girl in the guy band, the band of guys. I mean, we have gals in our band as well. There are two female backup. There are five singers in the band, and then five instrumentalists, or sometimes six instrumentalists. Usually the instrumentalists are male, but a lot of the singers are female. But it is fun when there are no other women there, and I'm the only chick. They all think that I'm one of the guys. So there's a little exposure to increase my worldview.
Understand the genders, right? My last question is just, you know, you are a host of this show. You get to use your chops as an actor, but you also, the one thing we didn't really talk about is you get to be a band leader in the way that you are not only hosting the show, but you are orchestrating from the stage. That's a skill. I've talked to a lot of different, we've had Lyle Lovett on talking about the idea of being a band leader.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that. Talk about like the transition of not just being a musician, but being the person on stage that leads the musicians.
It's so much fun to lead the band. You know, the guys who I hire, I make sure that I get the best guys in Chicago. I try to find the best players so that my job is much easier. If I hire the best drummer, then I don't have to say, hey, play it like this. I just say, what you got, Chuck? His name's Chuck Lacey. He's a phenomenal drummer. So I just love working with these guys. But leading the band, it's my job as leading the band. So here's how I learned how to do it, Justin. I went on YouTube and I was like, typed in
how to lead a band.
How to lead a band. How the heck to conduct
what
a
popped
band?
Up? Is it like instructional videos or did you watch like the band Rush or something? Like, how do you do
it? You can learn anything on YouTube. And I learned how the heck do you lead a band and look like you're some kind of, you know, professional.
Well, I love
and
it.
I conduct, I actually literally do conduct them, but I learned it all from YouTube.
If you want to see those skills on stage, Stephanie Rogers and her show Story Jam will be on stage at the City Winery this Sunday. It's an 11 o'clock start. 12 o'clock is when you're on stage, but there's an opening band, right?
Yes, two opening bands. One is called the Blackfriars Social Club. They're kind of Americana. And then this guy named Tanopoli is coming. He's a neo-soul artist.
All right, there you go. And then Story Jam at 12 at the City Winery in the West Loop. This show is on every other month. Is that the idea,
Just
Story Jam?
Just about every other month,
there
yeah.
There you go.
We change locations. So.
You do. Wilmette Theater. I know that. I saw that. That's great.
We do Architectural Artifacts, which is
a great place, too. Yeah,
yeah, that's a cool place.
Stephanie, great to see you. It's been too long, and you got to come back, and you should bring the band in. We should do some live stuff or something.
All right.
That'd be fun, right?
Yeah.
Great to see you, and good luck with the show.
Thanks so much, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right. Coming up at 10 o'clock tonight, Greg Flam is back. We took a week off when we were on vacation. Greg comes back in to do the swap meet, 312-981-7200. This is our segment where you can evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. Tell you how much that junk is worth that's up in the attic. I, as I said earlier, have pictures of my posters that I found. I found Richard J. Daley, or Richard M. Daley, excuse me. It's Time for Leadership posters. Full head of hair, the whole bit. Real nice ones. That's all it says. And I got a bumper sticker that says Richard M. Daley, Mayor 83. That's got to be worth like at least $25,000. I don't know how. I mean, I will think that, and then Greg will go, it's worth 25 cents. And I'll be like, man, I don't understand this game. So we'll do that at 10 o'clock, 312-981-7200. All right, this year marks the 10-year anniversary for Wild Claw Theater in Chicago. The company specializes in bringing the horror genre to life on stage. Wild Claw is probably best known for their radio festival called Death Scribe, which brings to life scary radio plays on stages like Lincoln Hall, where it's complete with a full band and a Foley artist. From what I saw, a Foley team making all the sound effects. The artist diminishes it. It looks like there's 15, 20 people back there cracking eggs and doing different things to make sounds. They got the latest play. Is it a night in Alachua County?
It's Alachua.
Alachua County. It's in previews now, opening Friday at the Den Theater in Wicker Park. In studio, Josh Zagorin, the artistic director of Wild Claw, also an actor performer around town. Josh, good to see you.
Good to see you. How are you, sir?
I'm good. We just had Stephanie Rogers, just missed her.
Oh, no kidding.
About how you gave her, you were late in giving her a story. She was complaining. She took like 25 minutes to complain about it.
You know, it's fine. And I'll take that because genius takes time.
That's what you always say. That's what.
That's. I mean, that's my Facebook status update for most of the time.
Every day. Wild Claw, congrats on 10 years.
Thank you.
Did I accurately describe Wild Claw being known for the horror, bringing the horror genre to life on stage?
Well, yeah, our mission statement is that we bring the world of horror to the stage. So, like, I mean, you got some of the wording wrong, but in reality, the meaning was there. No,
welcome
no, that's
to the story of my life, Josh. That's a
he means what he says, everybody.
He's close.
It's in there. It's in context. We bring the world of horror to the stage and have technically our 10-year anniversary would be February of 2018. So we're starting our celebration now because we're princesses.
Why not? Right,
and that's
right.
That's
how you do it. Where did this idea come from? Because when I think of the horror genre, obviously it's taken its rightful place on the screen.
Oh, that is true.
Because of the sound, the effects and what you can do with all the different ways to present horror. Where'd you come up with the idea for Wild Claw 10 years ago?
Oh, well, to be fair, I've only been with the company for four. I joined as an actor in around 2009, somewhere there. And then we had some management shifts, and then I took over as the artistic director, and then Maura Begale took over as the managing director. And then Chris Walsh took over as our lit manager, and Mandy Walsh, his lovely wife, and also her own person named Mandy. But I love when people say that. It's like, yeah, it's my wife. I'm like, also, they're your own person.
Also a person, right?
So, yeah, she's also a person. Mandy Walsh took over as the casting director because we lost four key players to children and family and moving. And from what I remember talking to the original, the OG, the legend series, as we call them, it was exactly what this is. It was a bunch of people that loved horror that were also working in theater at the time. And we're like, well, why don't we just do this?
Right.
And then that started. The first production was in 2008. That was the Great God Pan, if I'm not mistaken, and I am not. It's a H.P. Lovecraft wonderfulness, and then Dreams in the Witch House and that kind of thing came second. But the idea was Death Scribe is kind of what started this crew because they were out in front of the music, literally like in front of the Music Box Theater, which is where the first Death Scribe came from, saying, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this? And everyone said, yeah, it would, but it's never going to happen. And then it did. And then it, you know, begat this company. So I would say, yeah, it's a bunch of crazy kids in 2007 who thought this would be cool. And here we are.
Well,
10
I mean,
years
it's,
later.
It's kind of when I think about it and I think about the horror genre on stage, it's somewhat of a no-brainer. I mean, in the
right,
way
you'd
that
think,
thrill,
right?
Yeah, so I'm surprised that it's not done more often. Is it just that it's not categorized that way?
Because
he plays in other things that might be thrillers that would fall into the horror genre that don't necessarily call that in the theater?
Well, I mean, there are
psychological drama.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think that's because there's a stigma with horror. Like you say horror and everybody goes, oh, it's going to be bloody and schlocky and I don't want to deal with it. But then you realize, you know, that a lot of really great works that you are aware of that are considered classics, you know, began that genre, right? Dracula, to go even farther back, you know, Carmilla, and it's in there. You know, it's in the general, you know, mindset. You know, you love these things. You have an affination for horror, but you never want to say it because it's like, well, I don't want to be looked at as like a weirdo. And I'm like, Marvel movies are the number one film in the world right now. The nerds have taken over. So we can drop it, right? We're all cool with it.
Well, I think you see a resurgence in that regard. I mean, the Stephen King film that's coming out
this
week.
They say
I mean,
that it's going to be the number one horror film of all time.
I mean,
so we shall see.
Yeah, but you get this idea that is it because it's place and time? Meaning that maybe more people are, you know, interested in coming out of the shadows, if you will,
yeah,
to celebrate their love of horror.
I think that we're also looking at people that were in the before times. So like the 50s and 60s were considered the avant-garde or the nerds or the underground. Because being a nerd, you know, 60 years ago, you didn't say it. You didn't want people to know that. And you know, comic books and Tales from the Crypt, all of those things, Lights Out, all that stuff was, you didn't let your friends know because they really would beat you up. I mean, yeah, we've all been through stuff. You know, I'm 36, so like, I grew up in the 90s. So, but it was a little less like, oh, you're a nerd. It was more like, well, we just don't care. And you're like, right. You're like craving relevance, right, is what you were. But like back then, nah, you didn't talk about it. It was considered strange. And now all of those people are old enough, had children, and now those children are in charge of the major studios, the major networks. I mean, that's why we're seeing, you know, Marvel movies becoming the biggest movies in the world. If you'd have told me, and I hate to be that guy because I don't think I'm old enough to be like, you know, back in my day, but I'm gonna, because the technology revolution, I remember when phones had cords. So I'm sitting there going, yeah. Back in my day, if you'd have told me that we had a movie, a major blockbuster motion picture that had Thanos in it, Thanos, deep cut, man, I wouldn't have believed you. And I consistently want to go back in time and find myself at like 9 years old and go, bro, just stay the course.
Does,
man,
that rub off on theater companies that do, like for you guys? I mean, do you see more of an interest for people to come out and sample your works because more people are, I guess, are, I don't want to say out of the closet, but the idea that,
well, yeah,
that,
I mean, in the sense, mainstream, yeah, sure, yeah. Because and I can only speak from experience within the Chicago theater community. I mean, we have a couple of other theaters that we're in touch with around the country because, I mean, we're not the only horror theater. There's several. I think we're the only horror theater in Chicago for sure. But you find that a lot of these people, you see them on Facebook more regularly now because I think, yeah, people are starting to recognize. I mean, what number one movies was in, it started, I think it was like 2010, that like five of the top grossing films were horror films. And everybody knows about Get Out. Everybody knows about The Conjuring. And then you've got American Horror Story and Penny Dreadful.
Yeah, it seems to be in all genres. I mean, television,
well, and we can
film.
Thank Netflix for that because then they give the creative power to the artists. Shankar, who did the Castlevania anime that's on Netflix, which is fantastic, by the way, is another example of somebody who's just works in the business, happens to be a secret horror nerd, realized, oh yeah, I could do this because there's a want for it now. There's a need for it now. So I think that for us, we have our fans within the Chicago theater community that have been with us since the beginning, which again, it's only been 10 years, which is an amazing milestone for a theater company. But if you look at it in terms of like
life,
that's whatever. Cool. I mean, there's theater companies that have been around for 60 years. So cool. But we're very lucky that we can even say that. That have been through us from the beginning. But then you've got this great wave of new fans that go, oh, it's cool to like horror now? Oh, thank goodness.
Well, Josh Zagorin's my guest. He's the artistic director of Wildclaw Theater, which specializes in the horror genre for stage. They're celebrating their 10th year anniversary, a new show on stage at the Den Theater in Wicker Park starting this week. All right, I'm fascinated on what's the secret to staging horror. I mean, because I think about horror right off the bat, and I think you have to, I don't want to say treat it with kid gloves, because automatically, because of the way that horror was sort of played in the 80s and 90s, you do get a lot of schlock, a lot of blood. You can go camp. Mm. Camp is a big part of horror, right? I mean, that's right. You could do a whole thing where it's really a joke at how funny this chainsaw guy is.
Right, and there's a love for that, too.
But there is. But in this case, what's the secret to putting horror authentically on stage?
I would say atmosphere, because atmosphere and confidence. I believe that horror and comedy are sisters.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
In terms of timing and the way we look at humanity. But with this, with our end of things, because I personally come from a comedy background and try to bring that to our selection and whatever my advice can be, you know, whether you take it or don't take it when it comes to putting up shows. But I think that the secret to successful productions has always been aiming at, like I said, confidence. Like this is what we're going for. We're 100% serious about this, but that doesn't mean that it's, you know, morose, yeah. Right? We have a sense of humor and atmosphere. Like, we try to get you when you come in the door. Like, when you enter the space, you automatically get the flavor of what we're trying to give you. And that is our set design, our sound design, whether or not the lighting, like all of the experience of entering the room, I think is part of it.
Has to play. It is interesting because comedy and horror, when you say they're sisters, it's true because, you know, there are different levels in which people will laugh. Meaning, right, there's stuff they'll see a joke. I'm not interested in this improv show. It's not making me laugh. It's making the person next to me is going crazy. Right?
Yeah, and you can't relate to that.
Yeah, you can't. But, like, but in it. Horror, it's the same way. I mean, there is this different levels of scare.
Right. I think the number one thing that people ask me nowadays is it scary? And I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. I only assume it is. That's never really where we're aiming, because I can't. I mean, I hate to say it, but I don't know what scares you. I am not a demonic interstellar clown that came from outer space or another dimension or whatever that scene meant. I don't know what's your deepest, darkest fears. I have a general idea of what scares people. And timing, you know, I think, okay, better answer to your first question, or the previous question. I think timing, that's the best. We try
like
to aim
great
for
joke. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all timing. Yeah. Atmosphere helps. Yeah. Confidence helps. But if your timing is off, it doesn't work. And you can tell when a show in a movie, you can tell in a movie if the timing is wrong.
Yeah, right.
Cause you're like, ooh, they jumped it or they're moving too slow. Even if you don't find the concept scary or even if you don't get scared at movies, you can appreciate the timing of your jumps and your when you unveil the thing. It also depends on what story you're telling, right? Because horror is not like it's not like a flavor of ice cream. It's like ice cream. There's different kinds of horror that we enjoy. So if you're going – again, if you're going to be successful, know what you're going for. So present it with zero care. Be like, no, this is the vision. This is what I'm giving you. We're already off the charts because we're talking about monsters and demons and ghosts. So there's a freedom to it,
right?
And then get them when they walk in.
Well, you know, it's such an interesting idea. I mean, we're getting deeper than probably we should for talking about horror, but
I think we could go even deeper.
I mean, this idea of like primal fear of what people are afraid of. And it doesn't play out to sort of being spooked when someone jumps out at you, mm-hmm. or they'll
but
be
that
the
certainly
flavors.
Helps though.
Yeah, it does. That's timing. I mean, that's all about timing. Like how I can scare you in the moment. But there's something about the psychological connection. There's something about the emotional connection that makes horror work, and we see that a lot. I think that's why Stephen King is so good, and why we as a people continue to go towards his stuff. Is it's much less about chainsaws and I'm going to kill you in the worst possible way, and it's much more psychological.
The monster never is the monster. The monster represents something that's happened to you that you can relate to. So like the Babadook. It's not about the creature, although there is a creature and it is terrifying. It's about loss and acceptance of your loss. Mm. And the Babadook is that gnawing, giggling, giddy, scratchy creature that gnaws at the back of your head saying, hey, you're sad. You're sad. And you're going, no, I'm not. I can get through it. I can get it through. It's like, no, the more you ignore me, the worse I get. And so, you know, Dracula, it's about the fear of the foreigner, which is a primal thing, you know, as horrible as that is.
The stranger, right?
The stranger, right. You know, the rich stranger that's impossibly good at everything. Like what's their deal?
Something's going on.
Something's got to be happening. Right. Clearly they're eating people. Like that has to, that's how I feel about Justin Trudeau. Like whenever I see him on TV, I'm like, all right.
Something's up.
What's up with this guy? His hair is beautiful. His smile is perfect. His cheekbones are immaculate.
What do you have to do as artistic director to make sure that you balance the diversity of horror? I mean, I you know, like through a season.
What do you mean by the diversity
of
horror?
Like, I just mean that is there one show that you think of the first show is going to be a little bit more of the genre of we're gonna get you.
Yeah.
Is the second one going to be more of a slow psychological thrill? Do you think about that as an artistic director
over
a season?
Because, you know, getting back to that ice cream metaphor, mostly because I just really want ice cream, it's flavors, right? Like, the first show we did this season was The Woman in Black, which, I mean, we could talk about that for hours, but it was a dry, British, quiet ghost story, as all ghost stories should be, not necessarily dry and British, but quiet, because you know, you have to be very quiet if you want to hear ghosts, because they're not very loud. They're not on this plane. So that show was, when you walked in the room, everything was at a low whine, and the room was really, really lit from odd corners, and every little moment made you jump. And so we've done that, okay? And then the show that we're presenting that opens Friday, Alachua County, is loud and angry and violent, and it's all about family and how messy and terrible that can be. And there's demons, but I don't want to ruin it for you. But yeah, but it's the same kind of deal. There's things that you're not expecting coming from different sides, but this, we did a ghost thing already. Now we're doing demons. So, right. Yeah, we want, I mean, it's any good meal, you want different courses.
The,
right?
The play is called A Night in Alachua County. Mm-hmm. It's in previews now. It opens Friday at the Den Theater.
That's
in
true.
Wicker Park.
God, it opens Friday. We're fine.
You got to get back to it.
Everyone's fine.
Wild Claw celebrating their 10th anniversary. They are bringing the horror genre to life on stage and theaters. They've been doing it for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Josh DeGorn is the artistic director. Josh, great to see you.
Good to see you, sir.
Good luck with the show.
Come
and
see.
Look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, man.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here we are.
There we are. It's time for Swap Meet, sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Tonight, we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. Right? What do you want to brag about? I got tons to brag about, Greg. Yep. Greg Flam, at DuPage Picker, both at Twitter and Facebook. Good to see you. How are you, man?
I'm great. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, of course, man. I missed you. I was thinking about calling you last Wednesday on vacation. Be like, Greg, hey, what's up? What do you got?
Yeah, I needed your Wisconsin stuff from when you went on vacation.
There you go. All right. So I did get my pictures of my daily posters. We'll get to that in a second. But, Greg, of course, you join us every Wednesday, and you also bring in the treasure that you have found throughout the week to start off the swap meet. 312-981-7200. Greg, what do you got this week?
All right, so I went one more Bears poster.
Yeah,
I was
going to
end last episode, but this one is a giveaway that they did at a game, and I can't find out which game it was, but it's like 1997, 98.
Good years.
Yeah, and it's kind of the running backs throughout the whole history, really, of the Bears.
Would that be a Dick Geron Bears-led team, 1998? I feel like that would be a
97, 98, yeah.
Maybe at the end of Wanstead, beginning of Dick Geron. Real strong Bears seasons
right
there, if you're remembering that. Go ahead.
Right, and what we were discussing is what makes this a little bit hard to find and rare is the giveaway posters never really make it home. They're always, like, wrinkled up.
Yeah.
You're hitting your brother and sister with it throughout the game. You know, it's like, so it hardly makes it home in one piece. So that's kind of the unique thing about this. I could not find any of these online.
Right.
But, yeah, it's a smaller poster, but it's definitely not one of the iconic ones.
This is the running backs. So it's got Gale Sayers, Walter Payton, or as I was watching, I think it was Howard Cosell doing a – my buddy sent me a YouTube clip of the 1977 Bears season recap.
Okay.
I think it was NFL Films, and I think it was Cosell. He's like, Walter Payton, the way he said it, but it was all about Payton. So we got Payton, Sayers, a couple of guys with the leather helmets on.
Yeah, leather helmet. I mean, they go way back. I mean, this guy, Paddy Driscoll.
Oh, yeah. Paddy Driscoll, yeah. You know, Rashawn Salaam. I mean, this is 97, 98. No, they couldn't sneak him in.
They got a Neil Anderson.
Neil Anderson.
You know, but
no Ramon Harris? He didn't make the...
No, didn't make the cut.
The swap meet just...
got a Rick Caceres, though.
Oh, that's a good one. Rick Caceres, yeah. All right, so some good stuff there. What else you got tonight?
I brought in an assortment of election campaign buttons. I do have... I don't think I have a daily here, but I do have a cool Mayor Washington...
Which one was it saying?
Four mirror, but it says punch eight.
Right.
So, yeah, it's kind of
cool. Remember when they used to do that? That you just punch? They would say punch 10, punch 8.
Right, yeah. That's a
They outlawed era gone. That. They found that to be unconstitutional.
Oh, wow, yeah. Yep. Not enough information. I could see, punching a number. You don't know what you're doing.
I think it was the idea that you could just punch one number and it'd be the whole Democratic ticket without having to go through each race.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, as a voter, not a bad idea. You just walk in there. You don't have to do the judges.
Yeah, right. Sometimes there aren't any judges, right. In that section.
You're right.
Wow, in DuPage County, where I'm at.
But, so you got the election button, which is good. So let's talk about this. So I have, I found it. I have a picture of it. It is a Mayor Daley 1983 poster.
Mm-hmm.
Disheveled hair, full head of hair. Guy looks good.
Yep.
This is pre-Indiana Jones hat Daley,
yep.
Where he's trying to cover up what he's got going on. This is a young Daley, Richard M. Daley, and it says, time for leadership.
Yes.
I mean, what do you think? First of all, any signs online that say this is worth anything?
There is nothing online now. So you are
be
the only game in town. So that's a good thing.
All right, so let's start the bidding at $2,500.
Okay. And then in about 15 days after you've run that three times,
nobody
and no
wants
one's
it.
Bidding it.
I don't know, man.
We can come back down.
A lot of people who love 83 local politics.
Yeah.
No?
I would start it at probably $49.99 and see, what it
would. $49.99.
But that's still pretty good, though. I mean,
it is pretty good.
That's not bad.
Do you do that? Do you do the same sort of math as gas stations? You put a 99 on
I
the
do,
back end?
I do that still.
Yeah,
I don't know why, but I'm just follow that psychology, I guess.
Yeah, right.
Keeping it
looks a little cheaper.
Cents. Yeah, it does. And, but I do, another thing I do is free shipping. So it makes people click buy faster.
Well, okay. So I got a bumper sticker as well that says Richard M. Daley, 1983. Mm-hmm. So I could throw that in.
Yeah,
too.
Do a bundle.
So tonight it's a twofer. I mean, 312-981-7200. You can call in and get your collectibles evaluated, but you also can put a bid. I'm opening up the phone so you can put a bid in on my Daley poster.
Yeah.
You can tell me, or I'm open to barter. If you want to text in and say, I'll give you my 1983 Jane Byrne poster or the Jane Byrne coloring book that you brought in, Greg.
Right.
And then maybe I'll decide if I want to part ways and I'll send you my poster.
Start swapping.
We'll swap. Hey, swap me.
What a concept,
Greg.
Right.
All right, 312-981-7200. We got some coming in here, which is great, and we will get to them right after the break. Let's take a break, and I'll show you. I got some good pictures of some Chicago Bears posters that are coming in.
Ah, nice.
You'll like this. 312-981-7200. It's the swap meet. Stay with us. All right, swap meet, 312-981-7200. 815 says, hey, Justin, my cousin might like that poster. Are you posting it on a website? Well, I don't want to give away its IP, I mean, people could trace that. They could take some, who knows what computers can do today, right?
Right.
Yeah, I'll put it on Twitter, at Justin Kaufman. I'll put it on there once I'm done with this segment. I'll put it up there. Get a good filter on it.
Right.
Make it look real nice.
Right.
Real nice for the internet. See what people, because I'm an entrepreneur, Greg. I don't like to mess around. So my thing is, yes, I'd love to be able to swap this poster out here, but it's not, I'm shooting it out on the interwebs. I'm going to put it on Instagram, Twitter, maybe Facebooks. Not sure about Facebooks.
Right.
But I'm going to let people know that I've got this gem.
Right.
And I have Mike from the Gallery Cabaret to thank because he gave it to me years ago.
Yeah, you're golden. You're good with that.
Yeah, there you go. All right, 312-981-7200. Let's get right to, let's go to Sam. Sam, what do you want to brag about, Sam?
Hey, I got a pretty unique but maybe worthless playbill from a play called Extremities that Farrah Fawcett starred in.
Okay.
And she autographed it.
Nice.
And, I have no idea where I even got it, but how would I go about getting that authenticated and collect my millions?
Well, yeah, it might be worth sending that one in because Farrah stuff is pretty in demand. It usually gets decent money. I'd say offhand, I would list it starting at about $100 auction. Yeah. And
what's the play?
Extremities?
Extremities, Mm-hmm.
Is that the only signature on the playbill?
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's right on the face of the playbill. The playbill's in perfect shape. It's in plastic. And, I was just getting packed up to move our house, and I found it after probably 20 years of it sitting there.
Yeah, they charge about, 15, 20 bucks to get it authenticated, so it might be worth it if it's an auction starting at 100. That might be worth it. Or, Farrah's kind of a common signature. You might want to look online and see some samples and just judge for yourself if it looks real and just, wing it.
where do you normally take something like that for authentication?
You have to send it in. I think PSA is one company. If you Google that, there's a couple other companies that you can send it in, and they'll probably plastic seal that, you know, send it back to you.
All right. Well, that sounds good. If I make a million, I'll give you a call and buy dinner.
Yeah, and just, cool. If you do make a million, let's talk commission.
Right, and maybe you can afford the daily poster then.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
We didn't mention that part before, that if anyone makes any money off this stuff, then they got to give it back to you and me.
Right. That's only fair.
Yeah. But I want it in snacks.
All right.
I don't want it in cash. I want it in, like, dry almonds.
There you go.
Nice. Okay, so 312 says, Justin, I have a black and white photo of Elvis when he was younger without the frame. All right.
Okay.
Cool. Are you asking to Bart? You want my daily poster for that? No, thanks. Nah. Elvis ain't doing it for me. All right. Let's see here. 630's got a picture of the Black and Blues Brothers poster that we love so much.
Yeah.
My favorite, if you look at this picture, is it is electric taped up on a wall.
Nice.
So it's more of the Kaufman style of postering where you're like, taking that off is not going to work. But what a great poster. Just the one where Van Horn's got the briefcase. You brought this in the other week.
Yeah.
Oh, so good. They're all wearing the Blues Brothers hats. Love it.
Yep.
Love it. All right, 312-981-7200. Let's see. 708 says, laminated mint condition, Sports Illustrated magazines, Hampton issue is signed. Also a football signed by Walter, but in this case it's two Sports Illustrated, the one that says Superman. Classic, right? If you're listed from Chicago, you know that automatically.
Yep.
That's the one with Hampton holding his finger up and one of those loser Patriot quarterbacks, not named Brady, is on the ground.
Easton. I think it
might be Easton early. Yeah. And that's signed by Hampton. And then the other Sports Illustrated says Goodbye Sweetness, which is the death of Walter Payton. What do those go for? Do those go for anything? Laminated
Payton
covers?
Stuff, anything. Payton usually gets decent money. The Sports Illustrated in general are probably about $15 to $25. Unless they're signed, there are a handful of issues, like a Muhammad Ali issue or something like that, that could, you know, get up, I don't know, $70 to $100. The Superman one I think would easily be a $30 issue.
Okay. There you go, $30. There's another cutout. 708's got a cutout from a display in a grocery store from Coca-Cola. It's an anniversary 1985 anniversary Super Bowl. It's got Fensick, Dent, Sean Gale in the middle, which is kind of strange and random.
Yeah.
Otis Wilson and Dan Hampton.
Yeah.
I love that. So like the idea that Sean Gale somehow made the anniversary poster of five stars.
Yeah, that's
I mean, I like Sean Gale, but
Besides
picking up a miffed punt in the Giants playoff game, what did he do in the 85 Bears? Right? He's a rookie or so.
Yeah, and what that tells me is that the other stars didn't agree to maybe their likeness.
Gale got in because Duerson's like, nah, I'm out.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. It's a Jewel Osco cutout, Chicago, Coca-Cola, make it real. It looks good.
What I like about that is it's a promotional item, so there's not a million of them out there. So that's cool. Conditions is going to be a big thing on that, but I think you're probably going to be in the $60 to $100 range to start with that.
Because it's a promotion.
Yeah, it's promotional, yeah. Right.
All right, let's keep going. Bears poster from 1987, the 87 team.
Yeah, that's the
team.
I
think you had this one in here as well, man.
Yeah, they made those like every year from 84 to 91 or 92.
This is just them sitting in Lake Forest.
Those are generally $15, $10 to $15.
Yeah. That's interesting. Got a couple of guys I'm not familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And 87 Bears. Who's on the 87 Bears? I mean, I guess that's all the superstars still, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's Harbaugh, right? He's
right.
in by then.
Oh, yeah, but he's not in this picture. You've got Steve Fuller.
Okay.
Because he came in the middle of the season, didn't he? Wasn't he like a weird... They did like a weird draft on him.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. I only get interested in these posters when you start getting to the Vesty Jackson days. Anyone remember Vesty Jackson?
Right.
Say... He's more of a 90s or early.
Yeah.
All right. I'm done with the Bears. We're done with the Bears.
Right.
Okay. We're moving on from the Bears. Let's go on to something else. Let's go on to some technology. 847 says, I have an old iMac G3.
Yep.
But what makes this one special is that it was one of the two last models made. This one is called the Dalmatian because of the blue and white polka dot design. Far less of these models were made than your standard bold colored ones. True?
Yes, very true. And Apple stuff, especially 80s, Apple early 90s, is just, I think if people remember, I mentioned before, just the empty boxes of some of the Apple stuff, you'll get $50 just for an empty box.
Really?
Yeah. So he's in a good wheelhouse there. I'm trying to get a price for you.
Okay.
And I mean, just to give you an idea, a brochure featuring that same model, the Dalmatian model, is going for $15 just for a piece of paper.
Just for the paper that
the
says, hey.
Piece of paper brochure says
so
that this is coming out.
So if you actually have it.
And he's actually got it. So I'm guessing like $800 to $1,000.
Wow.
You know,
how about that?
That might be worthy of a trade for your daily poster.
I'll trade you the daily poster for the possible thousands of dollars for the old Apple yeah. computer. Does it work? If it doesn't work, I'm out.
Yeah, it might not even matter.
You know what? I'm gonna pass on that deal. I don't want because that's just so big. Where am I gonna put it?
Yeah,
this isn't necessarily about money, Greg. Like, let's make it clear. It's about what kind of value. I've got this poster of an 83, and the great thing about this poster is this is the only election I think in the history of the dailies
they lost,
in which they lost.
Yeah, right.
A time for leadership. Talk to the hand.
Right. He needed.
So that's what I'm saying. There's some specialness to it. So what? I mean, all these ideas. People coming in with like, oh, I got a computer that's worth thousands. No, that's not going to do it. We got to get a little bit more real, a little bit more emotional.
Step up. Yeah.
I want something closer to you. If that makes sense, right?
Okay.
All right. Here we go.
Let's do
all right. 815. I've got an original Star Wars poster with the Revenge of the Jedi written on the bottom. That's a good one because that's not Return of the Jedi. It's
right.
Revenge.
Yep.
Is that a real thing, or they just get it wrong?
No, they changed it. I noticed there was a jacket on. I think American Pick. No, not remember. Storage Wars. They had a jacket for that went for hundreds of dollars. And so obviously they started making some promo with that, and then they changed the name.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's a good item. A few hundred easily.
All right, here's a good one. 630's got a good one. Have a very unattractive cup made of rhino horn handed down from five generations. We think it's called a libation cup, but we're afraid to show it because we didn't even know it was legal.
Right, the rhino horn. Yeah.
It has a note from our great-great-grandpa with details.
Wow.
Well, what do you do with that?
Well,
yeah, because that's you can't like ivory. It was rhino horns going to get you in trouble, right?
Yeah, nowadays, yeah.
You never know who's undercover,
right?
Might be the rhino police.
Yep, poachers.
I automatically jumped to a scene of an undercover rhino cop being like, "Hey, yeah, let's see. You don't have by chance have a libation cup here, do you? Bring it out. Let's take a look." Yeah, I guess you can't do that.
Yeah, it's hard to put a price on that now.
847 get, yeah right 847 gets 847 gets the winner of the night so far. I garbage picked an Apple computer yesterday in Libertyville. Not sure if it works.
Nice. it doesn't matter. People want the parts.
Yeah, but just what kind of it? I mean the even
old,
a newer one?
The SEs. I mean, probably the last 5 years, you know, you'd have to hold on to that a little bit longer, but you know, 5 to 10 years and longer. They're collectible. I mean, people are going nuts over them. If it works, you know, the little SE compact one, those are going for like $300-$400, $1,000 I've seen. I mean, it's crazy. Mm.
262 says, I have a poster from 1972 of a man holding his head upside down in one hand and pouring Excedrin tablets into his head in the other hand. I ordered it from a Psychology Today magazine.
Wow.
It was an advertisement for Excedrin. Is it worth saving?
It's definitely worth saving. Yeah, I'm going to say it started at a $50 auction, but I have to look that up, and maybe after the news I can get a
look
price
on
that.
Yeah, just for a point of clarification before we go to the news, 847 says, no, I'm the owner of the Dalmatian. I garbage picked the Dalmatian.
Oh, the actual, you know, well...
There you go. So it doesn't work, probably, but still, like, being able to have an eye to say, I'm going to get this, that's going to get you money.
It's parts.
There you go.
You know, people will put a working one into that just to have the Dalmatian cover
of
the computer.
Good job on the garbage picking. All the other stuff you've garbage picked, terrible. Terrible. Yeah. Didn't work out for you. But this one, wow.
Well, the winner is the, what, Chess Records phone book or whatever it was.
That was
the best.
That was a good one. Greg Flamm in studio at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. You can check us out here, 312-981-7200, if you want to have us evaluate your collectibles, memorabilia. What do you want to brag about tonight? I have the 83 Mayor Daily poster, and I'm willing to swap with whatever you have.
I'm going to go ahead in the news and put it on Twitter at Justin Kaufman so you can see it in all of its glory because it's so pretty.
Nice.
I mean, it's the sexy daily. I mean, if you're going to look for the if you look for the dailies, which one's the sexiest? I think the 1983 daily.
Yep.
Might take the cake. Greg Flam pretty in hat. Studio. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Here we are.
That's right. At DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. It's a Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Time for the second half. Got some good stuff coming in. I did post. I was able to post on social media the picture of my Richard Daley, It's Time for Leadership for Mayor, 1983 poster. Real classic 80s haircut, too. Daley's looking fine. A scrunched up gray suit.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of maybe looks a little unshaven. Mouth kind of half open. Classic Daley.
But he means leadership because it's capital L.
It's capital L. It's time for leadership, and leadership is capitalized. Now, I did ask, what would you give it? This is what I said on both Instagrams. So Sandy Marshall, of course, our friend, he gave us two. He said, I'll trade you a Starbucks gift card. It's empty because I'm not sure what you like.
Is it the snowflake one or what design on it?
Just a card. You fill it. You use the money fill it. The second, he said, a copy of The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, unsigned. No, none of those.
Nope.
And then Scott Smith, who's our new media contributor, he said, an awkward hug. Give you an awkward hug for it. So not what I thought. Nope. Mike, also on Twitter, says, I don't have anything to trade. I'd like to buy that, though, for my cousin. He works for the city of Chicago and used to work for Daley. Hey, you're going to do better than that. I'd love to give it to you, Mike. I would. I'd love to give it to you. My hands are tied. You know, it's already out there. I'm not going to just give it to you. You got to think of it. And I don't want money. I said, I don't want money. It's not a money thing. It's a trade.
Right.
All right, 312-981-7200. Let's get to it. All right, so we've got this. Let's start with 815. They got a large mirror, a Miller High Life mirror with a bunch of football helmets surrounding it.
Yep.
NFL football helmet, since Miller High Life in the middle of the mirror, and a big, like, strange football right where the head would go. So the mirror is kind of unusable,
right?
But it's one of these promotional sort of NFL mirrors.
I did find one recently sold for $50.
$50 for that?
Yeah, so that's not too bad. And I think you could probably get more than that because he did buy it now. So if you did an auction, it might be more. Might be $100, $150.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I like my mirrors with not so much stuff on it.
Right. You want to see something. You know?
Right. 321 says, my grandfather's ukulele bought in Hawaii during World War I while in the Navy. This is an 1879 Hawaii. Wow. What's that worth?
Yeah.
That's a winner?
One just sold 400 plus.
What?
419 one just sold. So
what is
depending
a
on condition.
What's a regular ukulele go for, though? That's what you don't know, right?
No. Guitar Center, you could still get a ukulele. Yeah, yeah, $20, $25.
$20?
Yeah.
All right, so that's a big deal.
But for 1879 World War I, right. You know, not bad.
It looks good. It looks used because there's a little bit of, like, the wood on the back. There's a picture of it. It's a little used. But still, I mean, that gives it heart.
Yep, character.
Yeah. Let's go with Kathy. Kathy, what do you want to brag about, Kathy?
Hi, I called to brag about, I have it's a relatively small book, and it's called Chicago by Studs Terkel, and it was printed in 1986, and inside the actual book, he assigned it to our Totland town, Studs Terkel.
Oh, that's great.
Wow,
I love it. What's Studs Terkel stuff going for?
I'm trying to get that.
I love Studs. Studs means a lot to me. I had a chance to produce Studs Terkel at the end of his life. I had a chance to work with him a couple times. So, yeah. And I too have a couple. I have Division Street and a couple other things signed by him. So that's
this one is just Chicago and not the jacket, but after that, the first page, you can, it's like embossed, and you can see the outline of the city. And it was, like I said, it was published in 1986. It's probably more of a collector's item than...
Yeah, right, the editions later. Sorry to interrupt. So he didn't put a name when he signed it, right? There's no, like, to Carol or to whoever. It's just...
That
is good. That's really good because the value is up from that. If you put a person's name on it, it wouldn't be worth as much.
Right.
So that's a good thing. But it is a later edition, so that hurts, you know. But I'm thinking you're probably in the $40 to $100 range to start.
There you go.
And hopefully it goes up.
There you go. All right, thanks, Kathy.
Nice.
Thanks for calling in. Appreciate it.
He is just awesome. I mean, he was just an awesome person.
Yep, so, missed today.
Thank you.
Yep, his legacy lives on, that's for sure. The awards and everything, all the writers that come through here, storytellers as well. 312-981-7200. All right, let's keep going on the text. We got some good stuff here. Let's go down to, I got the 6-3-0 says, I got the 1961 Yankees program with Mantle and Maris, among others. I was just reading something or watching something that the Yankees, Roger Maris has the 61 asterisk, right? He's the guy with the home runs.
Yeah.
I sound like such a, like, guys never paid attention to the world of sports.
Right.
That the New York media at the time and the Yankees and everyone, they didn't want him to succeed because he wasn't as popular of a player as, say, Babe Ruth. That's who everyone loved, Babe Ruth, and before, you know, obviously before Roger Maris. Okay. But then there were other team guys on the team, Mickey Mantle and others. So, like, they were kind of like reluctantly, almost like Barry Bonds was, where everyone was kind of, if you weren't a San Francisco Giant fan, you were reluctant to celebrate his achievements because of the performance-enhancing drugs. But I just thought it was really interesting that, he, you know, we see his name and you don't think about any at the time, but I'm sure historians will say that he was, baseball historians, he was not, everyone wasn't cheering him on to try and break the record. They didn't want him to.
Yeah, he wasn't the poster child for the Yankees at the time. Yeah.
So what's a 1961 Yankees program?
One recently sold for $55. So, I don't know. Yeah, that's 61. There's another one for $43, so...
All right,
$40 to $60,
All right, 773's got a Ronald Reagan commemorative USPS envelope, first day of issue, 2005.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get
what does that mean? A commemorative envelope?
The post office, you know, put out, you know, they have the stamps and then they have the envelopes.
I didn't know
they already have that on the envelope. Yeah, so
But
I'm having trouble finding some of those. But I'm thinking, see, stamps are just really.
Yeah,
the needle in the haystack thing with that.
Yeah.
I'm going to save $10 to $12 for that, maybe.
All right, that's good. All right, let's keep going here. 630 says, I have over 1,045 RPM records, some rare originals in fair to good condition. That's I'm more of a bad to fair. This is fair to good, so that's better. My question, do they lose marketability without the record sleeves, Greg?
They do, and they're more... prone to scratches that way. So if you do have some good ones, you might want to, you know, you can buy sleeves on eBay or whatever and, you know, protect them a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, 45s, you know, I sold a Rolling Stones for 156. So I mean, vinyl obviously is very hot these days. If you have any kind of jazz or pop rock from whatever, from 40s to the 70s, you know, you probably got some good ones.
If you had some Steely Dan. Perhaps, right?
Yep.
This would be the week to try it out.
Yep.
If I'm a what you would call a crate digger. You know, I like to go and try to find old records. And it's frustrating when you go because it's always the same records.
Yeah. Is it really?
Every place you go, it's like 100 Dan Fogelbergs.
Right.
100 sticks, pieces of eight, or whatever. You know, it's like always the same stuff. Like, why did those records make it? Why did they buy so many?
Why are those left over?
Right. Can't explain it. I'm a record guy, too. I feel your pain. I see the same ones. It's either Grand Illusion or Pieces of Eight. You know, it's like, I don't know.
It's like when you go to the used CD store, which no longer exists, but it was just all Spin Doctors. And you're like, all right, we get it.
Right. Or Jim Blossom, yeah.
We don't need any more Toad the Wet Sprocket records. Right. We get it. We got it.
I was in a used CD store a couple weeks ago. And
you were?
I could not believe how little the CD section is. I mean, it's all gaming. It's all Marvel stuff. It's all video game stuff. And now it's just like one part of the wall is CDs. You know, like,
and it's still the Spin Doctors.
Yeah. Still. Know, or Enya or something, you know, like.
It's that one EP from the Happy Mondays. You're like, all right, right. We get it. Yep. You got an EP. Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker in studio tonight, 312-981-7200. I'm still waiting for the right barter for my 83 Daily, Mayor M. Richard M. Daley leadership poster. Classic, real classic. I mean, all the way around. I mean, you can frame it. You can do a lot of things. It really ties the room together.
I think you should trade for a Chicago Fest poster. I think that would look good in your office.
Yeah, it would.
Chicago Fest.
I mean, I'm thinking a little bit more. I think something in the hundreds range. Something that, like I said, like if I was going to start today, I would start the auction at least 1,800. Start it there and see where we go.
All
right. Greg Flamm in studio. We're doing Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. Stay with us. All right, Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. I'm loving people who are throwing ideas at me for the trade. Mike on Twitter says, I'm too young to have anything cool, except I have a 1998 Mint Matrix movie display. Been saving it for when I get my first apartment. I don't know how old Mike's at. I would assume 45, 50 years old. But look, he sends it out. Oh, nice, man. This is a full-on, like you'd see in the AMC.
Right.
That's a hardcore one. I would trade my poster for that, right? Well, then the only problem is I bring it home. I'm too old to have my first. I'm past the first apartment. I'm at the point where everything has been trimmed down to fit into my place. I don't think it's going to go over well when I'm trying to bring that through the front door. Hey, honey, come on down. Look what I got. The 10-year-old would be like, what is this? Why is the guy from... I don't even know what he would know Keanu Reeves from. Why is the grandpa from Blackish in leather?
Yeah, your son would be asking, do you really wear jackets that long?
Yeah, right. But I do like that. That would be fun. That's good. All right. Coming. All right. Let's keep going here. All right. How about I get 773 says, how about I get your son a job for the posters for Rich Daily?
Okay.
I know he has school, but don't worry, I'll have someone punch him in. That's great. That's what we're talking about.
Right.
All right, here we go. Let's go. Let's do Dave. Dave, what do you want to brag about, Dave?
Hey, I've got a cigar band collection that my brother gave me. My dad, when he was a young man in the 20s and 30s in Milwaukee here, he used to pick up cigar butts off the ground and whatever, and take the band, and he'd collect them. And my brother took them all, mounted them in a photo album, and they're all alphabetized and everything. It's very cool to look at. There's maybe 100 of them. A lot of them are Havana, and I'm wondering if that's worth anything.
They sure are. Just individual looking up here, go for $275 just for one band. Oh. So if you have a collection, you might want to start looking up, each of them and see. But you could have something in the thousands there.
Cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
There collection, you go, right?
There you go, buddy. So. That's a winner. Thanks, Dave. All right, let's keep going here. I have in my family, 630 says, a copy of the world's smallest printed book that was on display at the Chicago World's Fair in 1933. It was a tiny print of a Bible.
Wow, yeah. I've heard about that, but I've never... seen it. I'm trying to get a price. I don't think I'm going to find it because
it's so tiny.
Rare, yeah. I'll have to put glasses on to see
they're not going to be able to see it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a good one. I like that. Like tallest, world's smallest printed book.
I've got world's smallest dictionary for $325.
All right. Well, so, it's in that area, I'll bet. This is a Bible, though, so you're going to add at least 100 to that.
Right.
630 says, hey, Justin, since you didn't want money and you're looking to trade your poster, why don't you just make a donate? Whoever wants it, make a donation to the charity of your choice. Oh, that's so nice, but no.
Thanks. Thanks for listening.
Thanks. You've got a great heart, but I don't. Yep. In this case, this is cold, hard trade. I want something of Chicago value back to me.
10 to 11. Right. PC out the window.
Yeah, right. I mean, trust me. I give money. I give money to all sorts of things, but... Yep. This case, no. I'm not giving away charity for this poster. Yeah. I want something in return. And I'm not just talking about a full heart.
Right. Well, you're in Rod Blagojevich mode now. Yeah. You know.
I got this thing.
You got this thing.
I got this thing and it's golden, right? 847 says, what about commemorative coins from the Century of Progress Fair and from the Columbian Exhibition? What are they worth? Wow, coins?
Yep, good question.
So coins, commemorative coins from the Century of Progress Fair and from other two different fairs and the Columbian Exhibition.
All right.
I gotcha. Sorry I read that wrong.
No, we're good.
And from two different fairs.
That's some pretty good prices here. 400 plus for about a dozen coins.
Hmm. Wow, there you go.
Some individuals were $200 from the Columbian Expo. I couldn't get around to the other one.
Hmm. Okay, there you go. That's good, though.
It was good.
All right, let's keep going. 708 says, I have an autographed boxing glove and shoes from Muhammad Ali and a picture of his daughter presenting it to me.
Wow.
Wow, that's amazing. I'll take that for the daily poster, right? That's a good
right, one. That's pretty even.
No, that's a big deal to get an autographed boxing glove from Muhammad Ali.
And shoes.
And then have the picture of his daughter presenting it to him.
That is
seems like a
you're in the 7,000 to 10,000 plus range there.
Wow, but they must know that if they have a picture,
right? They're probably not going to part with it anyway. Yeah.
All right, I'll take it off their hands for the poster. I'll throw in the bumper sticker too.
Fair deal, right?
Fair deal. 847 says of a baseball sign for the 1972 Cubs, that classic team.
Right.
I guess that would have been an okay team, right? I mean, that would have been Ernie Banks still. Did Ernie Banks still play into the 70s? Yeah, he did, didn't he? He played probably till like the mid-70s. A Cubs fan will let me know that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pete, do you know that answer? Zimmerman says he's a big Cubs fan, but he doesn't know what's up.
I don't think he was around in 72. I think that's more Williams, Santo.
Yeah, right. Maybe a
Rick Monday, was he?
Yeah, right. There you go. Yeah. Now we're talking. There you go, Greg.
Yep. One sold for a 72 ball, sold for $250.
Wow. Jeez, Louise, man. I can't. All right. There you go. All right, let's go to Diane. Diane, what do you got, Diane? What do you want to brag about?
Hi. A 1931 Martin four-string tenor guitar.
Wow.
Hmm.
And you want to trade that up? Just straight up for a poster?
Actually, I didn't want to trade it. I was wondering what the price would be if I wanted to sell it.
Yep.
Okay.
We're getting there.
Well, here's my thought. I mean, if it comes back and it's a really great price, then I would say, are you interested in trading for a poster? If it comes back and it's not a great price, I'm not interested. So that's how it works.
Awesome. Would you guys be willing to let me know how much it is?
Yeah, we're looking it up right now.
Yeah,
what do you got?
They're going for about $2,000 if they're in
condition. Oh, my God.
Yeah. That's how much this daily poster's worth. See, right. An easy swap.
See? Should...
Wow.
You know, but...
Okay.
But, yeah,
that's a good
I couldn't
price,
find the exact year, 1931, but in the 40s, you know, there's some going for $2,000.
Right.
Wow.
Well, there you go.
Okay.
All right. Success.
Thanks for your help.
Thanks,
Diane. Thank you for listening.
All right. Thank you. All right. One last one. Listen to this one. 630 says, a Mills 25-cent horse head slot machine.
Hmm.
Original paint, and it works. What does that mean? Oh, a Mills. Is that a kind of Mills 25-cent horse head slot machine? Original paint, and it works.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, someone's asking $2,100 for one that's available. Let me see if I can get a sold price on there.
That's what they're asking for?
Yeah, one sold for $825, another for $1,600. They're kind of common. There's a handful here that sold.
There you go.
So you're probably, 1,000 to 1,800 range.
Wow. There you go. Nice. All right, well... Got some big winners tonight.
Yep.
Unfortunately, not me. Nobody's...
The search continues.
Nobody's going for the daily poster. But you know what? I'll just take it off the table. I'll do the Disney model, and I'll keep it off the table, and then everyone will be like, whatever happened to those daily posters? And I'll be like, I got one! Beanie Baby style. There was a Beanie Baby. There's one more Beanie... We'll get it next time.
Yeah, we'll get it.
And if we didn't get to you tonight, Come on back. We do this every Wednesday. Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker. You can see him at Wolf's Flea Market.
Yep,
You're out there every Sunday. Every Sunday at the
end of October.
Till the end of October. You can also find him at on Facebook and Twitter at DuPage Picker. Greg, great to see you. Thanks for coming in, buddy.
Thanks.
That'll do it tonight for The Download. Patty Vasquez coming up next. Pretty late with Patty Vasquez. She takes over here after the news. Tomorrow night, very excited about this. We have the man who was the creator of Source Magazine. Are you familiar with Source Magazine? It's one of the most influential magazines in hip-hop. And the man behind it is a Chicagoan, which is crazy to think about, right?